Hey folks, as you know, I am now a cat mom of two brother cats, and so I'm thinking about how to make them happy, how to make sure that they're healthy, that their coat is all shiny and nice, and the best way to do that is to make sure that they are eating healthily. And how do I achieve that? Well, with Smalls. Smalls has these incredible success stories with cats. Sam has spoken about how he has bribed his new cat into loving him. I am engaging in some of the same activities. My husband is more involved with the cat, so I have to resort to these cheap tricks of squeezing the little broth on in their food bowls to get them to love me. And Smalls has a bunch of different food solutions for your cats. Their cat food is a protein-packed product. They have recipes made with preservative-free, 100% human-grade ingredients you'll find in your fridge. And it's delivered right to your door. Smalls has fresh, gently cooked food, and it is made, as I mentioned, without preservatives. A balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and more silky shine. And really, I have noticed a difference in their coats. More of the nutrients in Smalls' food are digestible, so less junk comes out the other end, and that means less stinky stuff in that litter box. Smalls cat food leads to high protein and improved hydration. That's a big part of, sometimes, especially male cats, I've learned, can have issues with their kidneys and not getting enough moisture. Smalls cat food helps you solve that problem. That means stronger bones and toned muscles with that improved hydration. Cats use protein as their main energy source. More protein means more fuel and more sustained energy. Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food, and BuzzFeed says my cats went completely ballistic for this stuff. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. And if you're spooked by the commitment, well, you can try Smalls risk-free, and they will refund you if your cat will not eat their food. Stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts. For a limited time, because you are a Majority Report listener, get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/majority. That's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/majority. We will put a link to this in the video and episode descriptions. And at majority.fm. And now, time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Thursday, May 28th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Zachary Foster will be back with us of the Palestine Nexus newsletter, to talk about the latest in Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, East Jerusalem, and more. And later in the show, Dr. Adam Hamawi, candidate in New Jersey's 12th Congressional District, will be with us to talk about the primary, which is next Tuesday, June 2nd. Also on the program, food prices are set to rise for the second straight month after nearly 4 years of decline driven by the Iran war and climate change-driven extreme weather. Trump says he doesn't care about the midterms, though. Again, only the war. He also threatened to bomb Oman, a U.S. ally, yesterday. U.S. strikes resume in the Persian Gulf. Israel kills at least 14 people in Lebanon and at least 16 people in Gaza. Meanwhile, U.S. weapons manufacturers say they'll need at least 3 years to replenish the very pricey weapon systems that Iran took out with cheap drones. Trump refunds $20 billion to companies, with more to come after the Supreme Court declared his tariffs illegal. You think we're going to see that money? You think all these companies are going to send us checks for the tariffs we paid? Trump's DOJ reportedly launches a criminal investigation into his victim, E. Jean Carroll, who he was found liable for sexually assaulting in civil court. After pardoning a major Republican donor for illegal activity in his last term, Trump awards him an over $100 million contract from the DOJ. The Pentagon says it's preparing itself for a Cuba invasion, as the Cuban president roundly denies that they are an imminent threat to the U.S. because, yeah, no one's buying this. And lastly, Trump refiles his lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal over his Epstein ties that they reported on. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's an M Majority Report Thursday. Welcome, welcome. We've got a great show for you. Sam will be out tomorrow. He's got other business to attend to. The business of show. Not going to reveal what it is, but, you know, Sam's a...
It's also Thursday.
Sam's a thespian. No, tomorrow he won't be in. Tomorrow, yes, yes.
Please don't make tomorrow Thursday.
Yeah. Tomorrow is Friday. Promise you guys, tomorrow is Friday. You're nearly at the end. Let's touch on this here. As I mentioned, food prices are about to rise for the second straight month after nearly 4 years of declines. We know what rose prices. The once-in-a-lifetime, hopefully, COVID pandemic caused shutdowns across the globe. It resulted in supply chain bottlenecks. There were workers who were unable to work and process these goods. There was a backlog. There were shortages. And prices went up dramatically. Inflation really hit globally. The U.S. was a little bit more insulated from it, but still, the economic pain was immensely significant. And as of last month, the wage gains that people were experiencing have now been outpaced by the inflation that's been once again turbocharged by Trump. But this time, this isn't COVID. These are his actions, particularly as it relates to the war in Iran. So you have these factors here that are in play in terms of why food prices are going to be going up. You've got the Iran war, but you've also got extreme weather due to climate change, which Trump is turbocharging, and high costs for farmers, which are the result of his tariffs and his economic policies. So you can draw a line right back to Trump's decisions, and I hope the Democratic opposition party does so. Again, not holding our breath on that front, but some good Democrats should be doing that. Let's read this part of this really good Bloomberg piece on where we're at with food prices. The U.S. saw its warmest ever start to the year, with temperatures running about 6 degrees Fahrenheit above average through the end of April, according to the National Centers for Environmental Information. The early heat prompted some domestic crops to begin blossoming weeks ahead of schedule instead of remaining dormant throughout the winter, leaving them exposed to subsequent frosts, according to Brad Rippey, a USDA meteorologist. Beef prices, among the most politically sensitive in the U.S., rose to a record in April thanks to the smallest cattle herd in 75 years. Squeezed by drought and high production costs. And you can see this chart if we can scroll down slightly. Look at how high U.S. beef prices are as I said, 75-year high. And the higher costs on ranchers and farmers are the result of the tariffs. But in this instance, with beef specifically, this drought has been a major problem. And we're still going to be experiencing El Nino soon, which is going to make the climate change-related extreme weather even worse. Tomato prices, meanwhile, surged 33% over the last 2 months after two winter storms brought widespread damage during the peak of the growing season in Florida, while shipments from Mexico were declining following the Trump administration's imposition of duties on imports. If we could scroll down slightly. Heat and drought in the western and central U.S. spell more pressures to come. California accounts for almost half of annual U.S. vegetable and three-quarters of fruit and nut cash receipts. And diminished snowpack in the Sierra Nevada this year to just 23% of typical levels as of mid-April has raised concerns about irrigation supplies. Drought has also spread across the nation's breadbasket, where staple wheat crops that are typically used to make all-purpose flour or pasta have withered for lack of rain. As of May 19th, 70% of U.S. winter wheat production was in areas of drought, along with 25% of corn production, according to the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And forecasters now say an El Nino weather pattern is likely to emerge by August, with rising odds of an unusually powerful event, that will persist into 2027 and push global average temperatures higher. So this is the result of climate change. And I am begging Democrats to make the very easy case right now that we need to remove our dependency on fossil fuels. And you can make an economic argument, which is a lot more salient than the tree-hugging one, that's going to actually have political motivation behind it, really easily, by connecting it to imperialism, the war in Iran that is causing this, and to climate change, and those two things connect. Our wars in the Middle East, our involvement in the Middle East, is due to our overcommitment to oil and how the United States has maintained itself as a global hegemon by securing energy passages via military force and the petrodollar being dominant. We have to move ourselves off of fossil fuels if you don't want to be paying this amount of money at the gas pump. And if you want your food prices to be in a good place, also affected by the Iran war, because climate change is making these issues so much worse for you. And the Iran war is directly affecting food as well, because fertilizer prices are up 20%. Since the war began, one-third of fertilizer passes through the Strait of Hormuz. Plus, in addition, the cost of everything is going up because fuel itself is going up to transport anything. And our reserves are less than 2 months away, it appears, from being depleted. And then we're in five-alarm fire territory. But don't worry. Because Trump's not worried. Trump's not worried about how this is going to impact anybody, it seems like. When he talks about how America's been getting richer, he's almost exclusively talking about oil executives or AI executives. He's doesn't even really, I think, have the fortitude at this point in his life to, like, from a messaging standpoint, bring it back to the American people. He's just like, yeah, I don't care. I don't care if prices go up, essentially, because this is so important. Just a reminder, he ran on, we knew he was lying, but what he ran on to get the voters that he didn't previously was no new wars and I'm going to make prices go down. And now he's doing wars and saying, I don't care if prices go up because of the wars that I'm doing. So here he is saying, hey, Iran, if they're trying to hurt us in the midterms, I don't care.
It has no value. Their whole economic system is broken down. They thought they were going to outweigh me. You know, we'll outweigh him. He's got the midterms. I don't care about the midterms. Look what happened last night. That was the prelude to the midterms. People understand it. They know that very simple. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. I'm doing that for the world. I'm not doing it just for us.
Oh, wow. So magnanimous. He's doing it for the world. Where's that Nobel Peace Prize? He wants to dust it off? Because he didn't care about that at all. It wasn't for him. It is very revealing. He does this often. Remember when he kind of accidentally said that there were only 1.7 million people left in Gaza? He said that a while ago, and I don't know if that was a bad number, but it would also track with what we know about the fact that really hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza are unaccounted for and presumed dead. It would be interesting to know if that's what he knew. But he often does this. He just says things that you're not supposed to say publicly because he doesn't have the discipline. Like, he's revealing that he knows that Iran knows that their position strengthens as long as they continue to wait this out, and they can punish the United States with economic pain, and they want to disempower Trump and the Republicans in the midterms, which they have every right to try to hurt Trump politically as he's bombing the hell out of their country. It's just crazy how they are portrayed as the savages committed to violence when they're using just like actual political and geographic leverage. Who needs a nuke when even two nuclear powers bomb them, they're able to have resilience and use different kinds of pressure points to harm the administration. The problem is that just Trump, at least publicly, wants to pretend like he doesn't care about the midterms. I don't think he really does. But
I was already elected.
He was already elected, and he's a lame duck to this point. Like, what is on his legislative agenda? I think he'd prefer it, but he's more interested in personal glory in the way that he defines it. And there was something else that he said there that perhaps I wanted to touch on. But here's this other part of the press conference that he mentions Oman, and some people are wondering if Trump got Oman confused with another country. I don't think he did. This is what he said here about Oman, which is a longstanding U.S. ally.
No, the strait's going to be open to everybody. It's
and who would control it?
International waters. Nobody's going to control it. We're going to watch over it. We'll watch over it, but nobody's going to control it. That's part of the negotiation that we have. They would like to control it. Nobody's going to control it. It's international waters, and Oman will behave just like everybody else, and we'll have to blow them up. They understand that. They'll be fine.
Well, they'll be fine after we blow them up. Hey, so Oman is an ally. They have not yet joined the Abraham Accords, but Trump is also trying to incorporate the negotiations surrounding the Abraham Accords as well into the potential for a peace deal. That is, I don't know, like, he's already bit off more than he can chew. He's trying to bite into a live cow or something like that right now. That's not going to happen. You think you can bully these nations into the Abraham Accords after not just failing to protect the Gulf countries from Iran's retaliation because we were so much more interested in investing in Israel despite the security guarantees that we gave to some of the Gulf countries? Now you're threatening to bomb one of them because, I don't know, they're not sufficiently acquiescing to your demands, even though your standing with the Gulf countries has been rapidly deteriorating over the past few months since the war began. And I will say, because Oman has previously served as a mediator in U.S.-Iran talks, it very much is, once again, the Israelification of our military tactics, or at least our posture. Remember in last year when Israel bombed Qatar, which is a mediator country, and they had to like really apologize for that because it was a major issue. Saying this about Oman is absolutely insane.
Also, the Strait of Hormuz is not international waters.
That's exactly. We just had an IM who brought that in, saying it's not. It's within the borders of Oman and Iran. Which is, I mean, UAE also, I believe, I'm not great at thinking about maps off the top of my head. But yeah, it's, Iran, Trump is trying to look tough, through a series of Truth Social posts and bombing threats. And this. That is what I wanted to say. Dude, you're talking about the primary when you said, look what happened last night.
It's a prelude.
Yeah, yeah. You see, this is where it is. He does not care about the Republicans' chances. He cares about getting his guys
in. My guy
Ken Paxton, he won. Total sweep. And you're right. You have effectively made the entire Republican base into a cult that does whatever you want, regardless of what they purportedly cared about. Thomas Massie was all over the Epstein files. I don't care. Trump voters just care if you endorse the guy. You do have a cult behind you, and he enjoys the thrill of that. But that's not the general, buddy. That's not the general election. And you got to bank on a lot of turnout from those cranks as well. And I'm not necessarily sure you can bank on that, because people are looking at their bank accounts. Womp womp. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Zachary Foster. First, a word from some of our sponsors here. I've tossed a lot of her hair in the process, and she ended up using Nutrafol, and she was like, it was a godsend. It was a godsend for me. But for men, Nutrafol is also available. Sam has been taking the Nutrafol men's formula for quite a while, and look at that mane. He's, you know, not to age shame, but he's in his late 50s, and he's still got that full head of hair. Great spokesperson for this product in that regard. Nutrafol now offers hair growth supplements tailored to men at every age, because the root cause of hair thinning, causes of hair thinning change over time, and your routine should too. Nutrafol men for ages 18 to 49 to help improve hair growth and achieve thicker, fuller hair in 3 to 6 months, and new Nutrafol men 50 and over, the first and only hair growth product specifically formulated for men over 50, is available at Nutrafol. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement brand, trusted by over 1.5 million people. And it's not a pharmaceutical in that way. It's a supplement. So you can feel really great about putting it into your body, because they're backed by peer-reviewed studies and NSF content certified, the gold standard in third-party certification for supplements. Adding Nutrafol to your daily routine is easy. You can just order online. No prescription is needed. You can get automated deliveries and free shipping to keep you on track. Plus, with a Nutrafol subscription, you can save up to 20% and get added perks to support your hair growth journey. Start Nutrafol today and make the hat optional. Visit Nutrafol.com and enter promo code TMR10 for $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping. Find out why Nutrafol is the best-selling hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TMR10. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code TMR10, TMR10. Link down below in the video and episode descriptions. And lastly, I have been trying to reduce my single-use plastic. I got a little bit out of the habit in recent weeks of not bringing my thermos, unfortunately. But I don't have to feel too badly about myself, because I'm using Blue Land products all the time. And we know that Blue Land is one of the best companies out there when you want to kind of wean yourself off of single-use plastics. And we hear a lot about microplastics in oceans and food, but they can also come from products we use every day at home, including cleaning products. And I'd never thought really about how, you know, my cleaning routine might impact my plastic exposure when I'm thinking about these microplastics, but you gotta pay attention to the ingredients. Blue Land makes dish, laundry, and other household cleaning products designed to reduce single-use plastic. Their cleaning tablets are 100% plastic-free and microplastic-free. Blue Land is trusted in over 1 million homes, including mine. And I double-dip here, because we use it at the office. I just did a bunch of deep cleaning of the mugs yesterday. And Blue Land, their dish soap, which comes in a powder form, which is really cool, was how I got that done yesterday. Their dishwasher tablets, though, they're proven to perform on baked on, burnt on stains. No rinse aid is needed. You've got laundry tablets They lift stains from grass stains to food stains. They're hypoallergenic and safe for sensitive skin. And you've got toilet tablets that helps work on a wide range of stains, including rust, mineral deposits, hard water, and more. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Make the switch today. That's 15% off your first order at blueland.com/majority. blueland.com/majority. Link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Zachary Foster. We are back, and we are joined once again by friend of the show, Zachary Foster, historian of Palestine and editor-in-chief of the Palestine Nexus newsletter, which is really important because of how much material the Israeli government is attempting to destroy to pretend Palestine never existed. Your work makes sure that that is all archived. Zach, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Emma, thanks so much for having me.
Good to see you again, even though, of course, what we're about to be talking about is, yet again, Israel is out of control. I mean, of course, we know that the genocide is ongoing and never stopped, but it appears like as these negotiations with Iran continue as the weeks go on, Israel has decided to escalate in a variety of different ways, but particularly in Lebanon and Gaza, their bombing campaigns. Let's start with Lebanon, because there's also the ground invasion that we need to talk about. Israel just bombed Beirut some hours ago, the capital, and they have continuously now pushed past the yellow line in Lebanon, meaning they are attempting to make their ground invasion the ground invasion is expanding. What are you hearing about Lebanon right now?
Well, let's state the obvious. There is ostensibly a ceasefire in Lebanon right now, as we speak. There is supposed to be a ceasefire. Of course, Israel has not ceased fire over the past week or two, as the negotiations between the U.S. and Iran have gained steam, and as a memorandum of understanding seems to be on the horizon, Israel has decided to ramp up its attacks in Lebanon. And the reason is very obvious. Israel has no desire for a U.S.-Iranian deal. And Israel realizes that the easiest way to sabotage that deal is to carpet bomb Lebanon. And that's exactly what they've been doing over the past 72 hours. Israel has been pushing its ground forces further north. So the belief is that perhaps once this memorandum of understanding gets agreed to in however many days or weeks, Israel's freedom of action in Lebanon will be more limited, will be more restricted. And therefore, it is doing everything it can right now to push forward, to push this yellow line further north. They just issued a call, was it yesterday, or 2 days ago, they issued a forcible displacement order to everyone in Lebanon living below, what is it, the Zahrani River?
The Latani River, yes. No, and no, that's no. something, it's higher than that.
Correct. So if you look at the, if we have a map of Lebanon we can pull up, you'll see the Litani River, which is maybe covering about, you know, the Litani River crosses Lebanon east-west and then kind of veers up north. But if you go another 10, 20, 30 kilometers north of that, you have another river, is it the Zahrani River. They've issued an expulsion order. That's 40% of the country of Lebanon is now off limits to Lebanese. I mean, the Nazis had a word for this. It was called Lebensraum. Israel is quite literally trying to push basically half of the Lebanese population out of their homes so that they can literally take over half of Lebanon. That's where we're at right now. They've attacked Beirut. They're attacking the Baqa. They're carpet bombing villages across South Lebanon. They attacked a dam that if this dam were to break, you'd have tens of thousands of Lebanese that would, their homes would be flooded. They would be at a catastrophic risk of death. That's what Israel's doing right now, trying to wipe out half of the country of Lebanon.
We're pulling up that map right now, right, Matt? I think he's looking for one that can give us a little bit of a visual here. But the Litani River was typically the area where Israel would be battling with Hezbollah and also with kind of keeping their expansionist aims within that area, at least for the time being. But they moving beyond that is a dramatic escalation. They've bombed Beirut over the past few months as well. That was also considered a dramatic escalation. But this is essentially them saying that we are effectively going to be annexing 40% of the country of Lebanon, and what can you do about it?
They've issued an evacuation order for the city of Tyre, this Sur. This is, I believe, the fifth largest city in Lebanon. We're talking about 120,000 people. They issued, obviously, in addition to the evacuation orders they had already issued to Lebanese who were south of the Litani River. Now they issued another evacuation order. So this would include everyone north of the Litani, but south of the, is it the Zahrani River? I apologize if I'm
no, you're right. We have this map now here. This is the Litani that we can see here. And then above that is this other river that you're referring to.
Right.
It looks like. Yeah. So we're working on it. But yeah.
And meanwhile, the Lebanese government is engaged in negotiations with Israel in Washington, I believe. And
separate from Hezbollah, we should also be clear there, right? I mean, can you assess that a little bit for our audience and give people a breakdown as to why? I mean, it was framed as historic that the government of Lebanon was coming and meeting with Israel face to face in the United States. But the government of Lebanon is not the relevant actor here. It's Hezbollah.
Usually when there are two parties negotiating over a ceasefire deal, it's the parties that are actually fighting each other that are the ones negotiating together. Now, in the case of Israel and Lebanon, that's not the case, right? The Lebanese government barely controls much of Lebanon. The army has been systematically, over the course of many decades, stripped of any ability to have any real fighting capability at all. This has been an agreement between the U.S. and Israel for a long time, that Lebanon, that Israel needs to have military military dominance over all of its neighbors, including Lebanon. And so the Lebanese government can't defend Lebanon. In fact, you had families that were displaced in Lebanon. I saw this a photo, this video. It's truly remarkable. So Israel has expelled more than a million Lebanese people from their homes. They're trying to find shelter wherever they can, literally setting up tents on the sides of the roads, in front of factories, wherever they can, in front of schools. The Lebanese army is going around and pushing those Lebanese out. They're setting up tents in the wrong places. The Lebanese government is like partnering with Israel on displacing half of the country of Lebanon. It's quite remarkable.
And it makes sense as to why they want to circumvent Hezbollah there, but also makes total sense as well as to why Iran is attempting, and they have the leverage to do so, to maintain their support for Hezbollah and want Lebanon to be at the center of any agreement that comes into being, the non-aggression agreement that you're talking about there, which is important because if it's just a ceasefire that's discussed between the United States and Iran, that does not include Israel and it does not include Hezbollah. And Iran wants to make sure that its place regionally is still maintained in terms of its leverage against Israeli expansion in the region and takeover of the region. And support for Hezbollah is a big part of that.
Because Israel and the United States have pursued such an aggressive policy towards Iran over the decades, what Iran has decided, what it decided long ago, was that it needed to establish forward positions, i.e. Hezbollah, i.e. Ansarullah in Yemen, i.e. the Iraqi militias, i.e. the Assad government that was taken down last year. So that was the Iranian positioning. It was, we're going to support our allies, our co-religionists around the region, and that will be, act as a deterrent so that instead of attacking us, it's our allies that face the brunt of the blowback. So, of course, Iran feels this obligation to come to defend its co-religionists in Lebanon, especially because of how, I would say, especially because of how significant a fighting force they have become over the past few weeks and months. If you look at the videos that Hezbollah is releasing, these FPV drones that cannot be jammed by Israeli military at all, they are one after the other. I mean, I just saw this compilation of videos put out by a military analyst that compiles all these drone attacks on Israeli military targets, and the Israelis are totally defenseless. They have no response to it. You have these drones that are, like I said, Israeli military cannot jam them, and they're these fiber optic drones, and they're a couple hundred dollars to make, so Hezbollah has thousands of them, and one after the other, they can fire them directly onto and into Israeli military outposts that have been established on Lebanese territory. And so it's a complete nightmare for the Israelis. You see these, and they have video cameras on them. You can see them as they're attacking these Israeli positions. These are terrifying videos. Israelis running for Israeli soldiers illegally occupying and invading Lebanon, running for their lives. And this has obviously enraged Israeli authorities. And that's why you're seeing the most genocidal rhetoric that we've seen perhaps in many months coming from Israeli officials, yeah, which is saying quite a bit. I mean, these people are not do not mince their words. And now you have Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, both of them spewing out a really Nazi language. We will take down 10 buildings in Beirut for every single drone that you use to attack us. That's the language coming out of Israeli finance minister Bezalel Smotrich, straight up Nazi language. I mean, in Romania in 1941, that was Nazi policy. It was, for every one Nazi soldier killed, we're going to kill 50 or 100 Jews. It's just straight up Nazism.
Yeah, and the escalatory rhetoric is also echoed by Trump himself, and using bombing campaigns to force people into submission and supposedly weaken their negotiating position as it relates to, you know, Iran in and of itself. But that is not, it's not borne fruit. And the desperation of the Israeli government that you're speaking about there doesn't mean that we should underestimate their ability to execute it because of the amount of impunity that they've been given by the U.S. and the fact that I'm not sure where these negotiations with Iran go, because Trump is continuous, until we get some sort of agreement, it seems like Israel is going to try to do whatever they can in Lebanon and Gaza before that happens. One, to sabotage it, but two, because they are putting their foot on the gas. And I want to turn to Gaza now, because Netanyahu just said publicly and was bragging that he has now taken over more than 50% of the Gaza Strip, he now says 60% of the Gaza Strip. This is a part of the ethnic cleansing, and we know about the yellow line in Gaza, but they've expanded beyond it, and they're pushing the remaining Palestinians into smaller and smaller territories. And you see that clip of Netanyahu saying that to the audience, and they start chanting 100, 100. Reflect a little bit on where Gaza is right now. And of course, they've been bombing. They killed over a dozen people last night. Just continuously happens. But in terms of the land takeover, what's your view on that?
It's always strange. Israelis think Hebrew is some kind of secret language, that when Netanyahu says we're going to take over 70% of the Gaza Strip in Hebrew, that we don't have any way of understanding that here in the United States. Let's go back to October 9th, October 10th, 2025, because that was when this ceasefire deal was first reached. And it was supposed to be a three-phase deal. We're still in phase one. Israel has not even lived up to any of the things it agreed to do as part of the ceasefire deal. So that includes releasing Palestinian hostages. They did not release the number they said they would. They deported some of them to Egypt and Jordan rather than releasing them to their families in Gaza and the West Bank. They obviously never allowed in the humanitarian aid and the temporary shelters and the tents and the food and the water and the medicine that they said they would let in. I think on average over the past 6 months, so it's been more than 6 months since this quote-unquote ceasefire deal was reached, perhaps 100 to 200 trucks are entering Gaza every day. So that's about 1/6 to 1/3 of Gaza's medicine, food, and water needs and shelter needs. It's denied tents because the tents use metal poles. And so the metal poles could be repurposed to make rockets. And that's the and that's what Israel does. It provides excuse after excuse of why it's denying Gaza aid. Of course, Israel has killed almost 1,000 Palestinians in Gaza over the past 6+ months. The vast majority of whom are civilians. These are children who cross a line they didn't know existed, and an Israeli soldier snipes them with a shot to the head, or one of these Israeli drones takes them out, or a tank shell kills them. I mean, that's what Israel is doing on a daily basis. There has not been a single day since October 10th, 2025, that Israel has not violated this ceasefire deal. And as you said, over the past couple of days, we've seen Israel ramp up its attacks, killing 12 people in just last night. I mean, I don't know if you saw these images. I mean, we're kind of being brought back to the most violent and the most gruesome period of the genocide, where every day you see another image of another Palestinian child beheaded, just completely dismembered. And those are the images coming out of Gaza right now.
Right. And it's not a coincidence that they are escalating during Eid as well. This is a long-standing tactic by the Israeli government on Muslim holidays.
It's also worth mentioning that it's not just that Israel is violating all the things it agreed to do, but what is it doing in the 60, perhaps now 70% of the Gaza Strip that Israel controls? Let's remember, there are still multiple Palestinian militias. I would call them terrorist organizations. These organizations are run by criminals, rapists, thieves, drug dealers, murderers. These are the only people willing to collaborate with the Israeli military. And there's two or three of these gangs, the Dagmush gang, Abu Shabab's gang, although Abu Shabab was killed, his gang still survives. So you have three or four of these militias in the Israeli-controlled territory of the Gaza Strip. And there was a video that just surfaced of one of these gangs that Israel had given this gang one of these very sophisticated Israeli drones. Quite a remarkable video. This was just published by DropSite earlier today. Now, let me ask yourself, why would Israel be giving sophisticated, armed, deadly drones to Palestinian militias on the eastern side of the Gaza Strip? They're planting the seeds of a civil war.
Yep.
That's what they've been trying to do in Gaza for quite literally 2 years. There are reports that go back to November, December 2023 of Israel trying to arm militias in the Gaza Strip. This has been a 2.5-year-long project to create internal strife and civil war, such that the Gaza Strip not only is a place without any shelter and without adequate food or without any hospitals or without clean water, but it's also a place where Palestinians are killing other Palestinians. Mm-hmm. That is Israel's goal for the Gaza Strip, to make it completely and totally unlivable, such that everyone has to leave. And that's what they've been doing for 2.5 years.
Yeah. And as they continue to take more and more territory and cram the remaining Palestinians into smaller and smaller territory, as we talked about earlier, and there are no cops on the beat. The Trump administration appears to be okay with whatever Israel does as long as it doesn't make headlines in the United States. But we should also point out that the violence in the West Bank and the settler violence and in East Jerusalem has also escalated over the past few weeks. What are you hearing on that front?
So maybe we can start with the East Jerusalem. Recall that in 1967, Israel annexed some 70 square kilometers of the West Bank, including Jerusalem, and then called the whole thing East Jerusalem. And in 1970, they passed a law that said that if at any point in history, any Jew once owned property in East Jerusalem or anywhere in the West Bank, that any other Jew has the God-given right to go reclaim that property. Now, obviously, the law doesn't work in reverse, right? If you're a Palestinian who once owned property in any part of Israel, you have no right to reclaim your property.
No right to return.
No right to return, no right to reclaim your property. So it's a blatantly racist law that has been used over the past 58 years in East Jerusalem and Hebron and other areas of the West Bank to steal Palestinian property. And this is right now happening at an accelerating pace throughout the old city of Jerusalem, Souk al-Ananin. It's happening in Sheikh Jarrah, famously. Muhammad al-Kur, Munir al-Kur, these Palestinians were who are very outspoken, speak to those those forcible displacements with great, clarity. But now it's also happening. It's also happening in Silwan, which is the Palestinian neighborhood just outside the old city of Jerusalem, just actually outside the Western Wall compound. And so it's considered an important neighborhood for Israel. You have an archaeological park in that neighborhood known as Ir David, or the City of David, which Israeli archaeologists claim once was home to the kingdom, some palace that once belonged to David, to King David, the ancient Israelite figure in the Bible 3,000 years ago. Now, I've talked to many archaeologists who say the whole park is actually, there's basically no evidence to suggest this was actually King David's park. It's all political. This park was built, and the history is basically being fabricated in order to push Palestinians out of the city. And you have a B'Tselem report, and I believe this is based on an Israeli military order to ethnically cleanse the entirety of the neighborhood. We're talking 2,000 people. Yeah. And that could happen at any moment. Remember, the vast majority of homes in East Jerusalem, so we're talking 300,000 Palestinians live in East Jerusalem, the majority of the properties owned by Palestinians in East Jerusalem could be demolished at any moment. That's because when Israel occupied East Jerusalem in 1967, they established a permit regime that effectively denied Palestinians building permits to build new homes. What they did was they encircled around all the built-up areas of East Jerusalem. They drew lines. They drew these zoning lines that said you cannot build outside of the already built-up areas in East Jerusalem. And that's why when you drive around East Jerusalem, there's open areas everywhere, these large open areas, and you're wondering, this makes no sense.
Right.
But the reason is very simple. Israel does not want Palestinians to build in Jerusalem. It wants them to leave Jerusalem because it wants to preserve a supermajority, a Jewish supermajority in Israel's capital. And now it's not just denying Palestinians the right to the build. It's actively pushing them all out. And Silwan is just the latest example of that.
Yes, and it gets less attention because I think, one, because the occupation and the seizure of land happened so long ago, but also I think, the settlement operation in the West Bank and the rolling just violence that we see there, it's escalating too. It's just been like, I think, more in people's public minds about it, because I think, we see some of the images. There's been great reporting from independent journalists in the West Bank and others about what just the casual violence that is inflicted on Palestinians there, and how the how much that's been escalating, I guess, over the past few years. Before we wrap here, Zach, if you could just give us an update on the West Bank.
Yeah, so since October 7th, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. And this is a very violent process that involves forcible expulsions. So we're talking about pogroms in which Israeli settler terrorists, sometimes dozens of them, sometimes hundreds of them, at night, during the day, in the morning, in the evening, about 12 happen every day. Those are the latest numbers. So we're talking 12 terrorist attacks every day on Palestinian communities. Oftentimes, these shepherding and herding communities in Area C of the West Bank, in the Jordan Valley, South Hebron Hills, the E1 zone, the area, yep, areas around Nablus, areas around Sebastia, right? So all the, basically wherever you go in the West Bank, there are active attempts by Israeli settler terrorists to forcibly expel Palestinians from their homes. I think the most, South Hebron Hills is very active. Just the other day, Mohammed Hisham, a Palestinian from Masaf Ariyata, reported on Israeli settler terrorists beating Palestinians with metal sticks and metal rods in the middle of the night. We just saw that video surface the other day. Now they're trying to expel the residents of Khan al-Ahmar, which is in the E1 zone. This is the area that U.S. and EU leaders have claimed is a red line for quite literally decades, because it's this area that lies right in the center of the West Bank. And so if Israel takes it over, in theory, that would dissect the West Bank into two, effectively making a Palestinian state impossible, even though it's been impossible for decades, because no, right, Israeli leader, not on the left, not on the far left, not even Meretz, which is the far leftist Israeli political party you're going to find, not even Meretz is interested in even talking about a Palestinian state. So the full Israeli spectrum from left to right is Jewish supremacy from the river to the sea. And that is reflected every single day in the West Bank. And let me just make one final point. You saw that in December 2024 and January 2025, the Israeli military expelled about 40,000 Palestinians from the Jenin, Tul Karim, and Nur Shams refugee camps. Now, just in the past week, what they're doing is they're building Israeli military bases in those refugee camps, in Area A, in areas where they're not even supposed to be in the first place, according to the Oslo Accords. They're quite literally throwing the Oslo Accords in the garbage. I mean, they've obviously been doing that for three decades, but they're just making that policy official now. And you're not going to be able to return to your home if you're a Palestinian from Jenin, Tul Karim, or Nur Shams refugee camps, because those camps are now being turned into Israeli military bases.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely unconscionable. And it's incredible to see, I think, you know, the tactics that we've seen in the West Bank being used in Lebanon, with no real recourse whatsoever, and with, you know, an administration here in the U.S. that could yank on the leash at any point, but actively chooses not to. Same thing that we discussed with the Biden administration as well. Zachary Foster, really appreciate your time today. Everyone should check out the Palestine Nexus and your work on that newsletter, editor-in-chief of the Palestine Nexus newsletter. Thanks so much. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Quick break, folks. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Adam Hamawi, candidate in New Jersey's 12th congressional district. We are back, folks, and we are joined now by Dr. Adam Hamawi, candidate in New Jersey's 12th congressional district. Dr. Hamawi, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So, of course, I'm from New Jersey, by the way. I'm from Essex County, so I do have to ask you some quick questions right off the rip. Your district is what I would say is in central Jersey. Some people deny that Central Jersey exists. It's just north and south. So I would like your answer here. Do you believe that there is such a thing as Central Jersey?
Of course. You know, there is something else that exists below Newark, and there's a Central Jersey. And then there's South Jersey, which is really out in the middle of nowhere. But you could bring that up with them.
Okay, I'll bring it up with them. You accept the existence of Central Jersey, and then I need to follow up in that instance, because if Central Jersey exists, what is it, pork roll or Taylor ham?
Neither one. I'm halal, so I...
Okay. All right, fair enough, fair enough. For people that don't know, it's a real controversy. North Jersey people say it's called Taylor ham. South Jersey says it's pork roll. But, you know, that was a very diplomatic answer for you there, Dr. Hamoui. You've been endorsed by CARE, Track APAC, Justice Democrats, Bernie Sanders, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Summer Lee. I could go on in your race. You've got a lot of great endorsements. What do those endorsements mean to you, and what does it say about the nature of your candidacy?
So I'm honored, first of all, to have been able to earn those endorsements. It's a lot of hard work, and it really reflects what's happening here on the ground. You know, someone like Senator Sanders and really all the organizations really look at what you're doing here in a district. If you're speaking to the people on the ground, what kind of campaign? We have a large grassroots movement here where people are knocking on doors. We've built a coalition that really spans not just a progressive space, but, you know, I have progressives, I have pro-Palestinian groups, I have veterans groups, science, climate change. It really shows the full spectrum of the district here. And in New Jersey, Central Jersey, where I'm at, it's progressive. People are intelligent. They are active, and they are thirsty for someone that's going to speak to them and their needs, and not the same politics as usual, which is unfortunately what we've seen fill Washington, D.C. And you know, this is the district that belongs to Bonnie Watson Coleman, who's retiring and stepping down. And we need someone like her who's going to be speaking to what the people want and what the people need, and continue her fight in Washington.
You mentioned your district. It's a really interesting district because it's a mix of affluent suburbs like Princeton, but you also have more middle-income diverse suburbs too, like Plainsboro. You got North-South Brunswick, I believe. And then you have smaller cities like Trenton and Plainfield that have, say, like larger Black and Latino population. There's also a large Asian population in the district. Like, it's as diverse economically, racially as it gets, but it's also a very blue district. So can you reflect on what it means, I guess, to run in that district and what the needs of those constituents are, despite the fact that it's such a wide range of people?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the most diverse districts in the entire country. We have the whole breadth of socioeconomic range, like from Trenton to Princeton, and they're only about 20 minutes apart. And we have the same thing of also the cultures. I mean, we're right here where we have people from all countries that are immigrants working. And we have – so to run in a district like this, you have to be able to – you know, speak to actual people's needs. You can't be really representing one small group and think that you're going to succeed here. You have to be able to walk into communities, be able to relate to the problems that they have, and speak from experience rather than talk at them. And this is what I felt is me being a physician who's been working in Central Jersey for most of my life, seeing, you know, these people come in as my patients. I know the problems that people face because I see it every single day. And I think that's what's really helped me, you know, connect with most of the voters here.
You mentioned your work as a physician. I think it's important for us to mention how incredible your work has been in war zones. I did not know that you treated Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, who lost both of her legs in Iraq, and she was integral in lobbying the Biden administration at the time because you and your team were in Gaza performing surgeries on victims of the Israeli genocide. And there was no one advocating for you, and Tammy Duckworth was like, this man treated me. I mean, speak about your story, because it's quite remarkable.
Yeah, our connection goes back a long time. And I was a combat trauma surgeon in Iraq in 2004 when her Black Hawk was shot down with an RPG. And I was the surgeon that took care of her and stabilized her, was able to, you know, have her survive that initial injury and get onto an evacuation back to Germany and eventually back to the United States. So I treated her and was able to save her life back then. And she returned the favor to me many years later, 2 years ago when I was in Gaza with the medical team on a mission. And our team got trapped in there when Israel closed the and seized the border between Egypt and Gaza. And after a lot of pressure trying to get out, she was like one of the people in Washington and really pushed the Israelis to allow our team to leave.
And can you talk about your experience there? We've had doctors on our program speaking about the horrors of the Israeli genocide. I know you operated on many children. What would you want our audience to know about your experience there?
So I've been doing this for over 30 years. So in addition to being a combat trauma surgeon in Iraq with the U.S. Army, I've also volunteered in war zones all over the world. I've been to Central America. I've been all over the Middle East. And what I saw in Gaza was something completely different at a scale much larger, where there's deliberate targeting of civilians every single day. And seeing that horror, like, at the, you know, that my tax dollars were funding, fundamentally changed the way I look at politics and really pushed me to get involved. Because normally after my mission trips, I come back, I work, I go back to my, you know, my practice and, you know, cover, you know, my district and take care of them. I couldn't do that anymore just to forget about what I saw. I needed to be a witness, and I started going to D.C., working with, you know, Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman, working with, you know, many of the senators, trying to talk to them and reach, you know, tell them this is what our country is using its resources for, is to fund the genocide. Unfortunately, most of the lawmakers wouldn't even give me an audience. They wouldn't open their doors and listen to what I had to say, whether they agreed to or not. And it's that reason why when Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman decided to, you know, retire this year, I felt I had to jump in and I had to go there, because my perspective is fundamentally needed there, because we need these resources right here at home. I mean, I'm in Trenton right now. You know, we have problems with infrastructure. We have problems with healthcare. People don't have insurance. They're trying to pay their medical bills. At the same time, they can't afford their rent. And at the same time, I saw that we're spending it on bombs. We're spending it on, you know, on aircraft carriers and stealth bombers. I've seen both sides of this, and we're just making the wrong choices. So that's
It gives a whole new meaning to Trenton Makes the World Takes, which is the slogan. I mean, that, like, yeah. This is a question of resource allocation, and I'm glad to hear you speak about it in those terms, because, you know, just in, for example, in what we've spent on this war in Iran, we could clearly fund College for All and other major programs, for example, which are you, if I'm not sure if you're in favor of College for All, you can expand on some of your other policy positions, but I think people can really fundamentally understand when you show them what our tax dollars are going to and what it could happen, could be going to in their everyday life.
Absolutely. I mean, we're told that we can't afford Medicare for All, but we have been spending $1 billion a day on this war. With just, you know, from when we started to now, we could have eliminated medical debt, you know, in the United States. We could have funded, you know, tuition-free public education. You know, think of the infrastructure projects and fixing roads or building housing or, you know, so many things that we need right here that every day we're told that it's like, we don't have the budget for it, we can't afford it, like, it's going to increase our taxes. No, we could definitely afford these things. We're seeing that when we need to make bombs, there's no hesitation, you know? So between, you know, $1 trillion a year that they're saying that they want to make a $1.5 trillion a year, for a War Department, because that's really the only thing it really is. You know, we call it the Department of Defense. The only, you know, correct thing the Trump administration did was fix the name, because that's all it is. And we're funding the military industrial complex. We're funding Boeing. We're funding, you know, Lockheed Martin. We're Raytheon. We're making all these bombs, and they're thriving right now. They're booming because they can't keep up with the demand. At the same time, people are struggling, working 40 hours a week, you know, to be able to put food on their table, pay rent. They're doing all the right things, and yet they're falling behind every single year. And this can't go on. This can't be normal. And we need to fix that. Otherwise, you know, this whole country is falling apart, you know, and we see this happening, and it's getting worse every single year. And we need new leaders in Washington that are going to address these problems once and for all. And that's what I plan to do.
Absolutely. Again, June 2nd is the primary. Just want to make sure we sprinkle that in throughout the interview so people know if they haven't voted yet, just less than a week away. Sorry.
And the polls are open right now. So it's not just June 2nd. If you could go out and vote today or tomorrow, they're open all the way till Sunday. So get out the vote. If you have ballots at home, fill them out and send them. It's not doing any good in the kitchen table.
Exactly right. I wanted to just quickly, though, turn to the ICE protests, not in your district. It's north of you in Newark, about the conditions in this detention facility in Newark, run, of course, by a private company, Geo Group. It's been a real flashpoint right now in politics in New Jersey. I was encouraged to see Senator Andy Kim show up there, and he was actually pepper sprayed. Unfortunately, Cory Booker, no show, even though he used to be the mayor of Newark, interestingly. What would your leadership look like? Would it be more, you know, what we're seeing with, say, Representative McIver and Mejia, Representative Mejia, or are we talking Cory Booker, no show?
Well, I was there. I was.
Oh, you
there.
Were there. There you go.
I was there. Yes, I was. I was there on, I'm losing track of the days now, but I was there with Andy Kim, and Anna Lilia was there as well. We have, so many of our, you know, the delegation actually showed up, which is like great. And that makes the absence of certain people even more apparent. And yes. If we're not going to go and stand up to fascism and tyranny when it's right here at home and in our state, then how could we expect, you know, to be able to stand up for it in Washington? Because we are supposed to be the voice of the people. We're the representatives here. And whether it's in your district or not, it's all connected. And it's like you said, you know, Geo Group is a for-profit group. Again, we're talking about allocations and money. We've spent $170 billion giving it to ICE. And that's not including the $9 million a day we're spending for these private, you know, for-profit prisons that are just, you know, making money, you know, day after day off the misery of others. And, you know, I was there. They had masked stormtroopers there, full body armor. They had a armored vehicle with, you know, this pepper spray gun right on top, aimed at the protesters, and just waiting for a fight. And every day there's something. Like just two nights ago, they kidnapped a Army, he's a veteran. I don't know if he's Army. He's a veteran medic. They rushed into the crab,
yeah,
beat him up, took him, and then they like drove him off and dropped him beat up, like, you know, miles away in the middle of the street at night, just like some it's like some gang. You know, these are the troops that are being used by this administration. And another reason why we need to abolish ICE. I mean, at this point, they're just a bunch of criminals terrorizing the community and not really making anyone feel any safer.
And it's also a question of resource allocation. Like, I mean, how would you respond to people saying, hey, I support a lot of your positions, but I'm a little scared to abolish ICE. I'm throwing this out there, even though I agree with your position. How do you answer that question? Because I think sometimes people, the abolition language can freak them out, right? Like defund the police maybe wasn't the best slogan. It's about changing resources to go to different parts of public safety. It's the same thing here with immigration enforcement.
So there was life before ICE. You know, ICE was formed in 2003 after 9/11. And the excuse, first of all, it was done in a rush. The excuse was, again, border security. But they failed at their task. You know, there's the southern border doesn't stop at Trenton. And yet they're in the streets every day, you know, picking up, you know, people dropping their kids off at school. You know, they are not making people any safer. And they seem to be targeting really only black and brown communities. This is not an immigration system. So, yes, we should have a system that's orderly, that allows people to legally come in with a process that's known, that allows talent to come into this country, which is really how this country was built, with the help of immigrants, generation after generation, which is what made this country what it is today. And we should be able to respect human rights. We should be able to respect civil liberties and have a process that doesn't have people waiting decades to be able to rejoin families or have a lottery system. You know, this isn't reinventing the wheel. It's about, you know, picking a priority. And this has been dropped by both parties. You know, every time they come in, they say they're going to fix it, but the other party opposes it. And it's a failure for both. And it's about time that we addressed it in a real manner rather than, you know, copping out and saying the only way to do it is to just, you know, grab everyone off the streets and just ship them somewhere else.
Well, I really appreciate your time today, especially ahead of a, you know, really busy next few days for you before Election Day on Tuesday, June 2nd. But as the good doctor mentioned, you can vote in New Jersey all the way up to Sunday prior to that. Really appreciate your time today. Dr. Hamawi, a surgeon running to represent New Jersey's 12th Congressional District in Congress. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And we will put a link to your website where people can help and get out the vote in the final hour, final hours of this race down below wherever people are listening to or watching this.
Yes, go to hamawifornj.com. Thank you all very much. Get out to vote.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you coming on the show and best of luck.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. All right, folks, with that, we're going to wrap up the free part of the show and head into the not-so-free but often so fun half of the program. As a reminder, this show relies on your support. We've been a little bit not getting in people's feeds, according to Sam. Wonder why. Good. You know, our title of the video being Israel is not going to impact that at all, right? So what we do need is for our lovely audience to join the Majority Report, jointhemajorityreport.com. It helps us be resilient even when things are more precarious because we have to broadcast on third-party platforms that we can't control. But when we have our members, and you can IM the show when you become a member, you're able to make sure that this show is surviving and thriving, as Sam would say, and that you're able to, you know, listen to us if you enjoy doing so. So you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, and chocolate?
I never remember.
At least coffee. Check them out, folks. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning with the Jacobin Show?
New Jacobin Show coming up tomorrow. Abby Martin talking about a couple of her documentaries, the one on the military being the largest polluter, and also talking about Cuba. So two big topics for Abby Martin's first appearance on the Jacobin Show tomorrow, right after Majority Report's over.
Amazing. All right.
We don't have Brendan or Matt yet.
Okay, well, soon we will have Brandon and Matt. Check out the discourse. Check out everything Matt Binder is doing. Leftist Mafias tonight, for example. All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. Are you nervous? You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
We are back, and we have Matt Binder. Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you?
I am doing well. How or what's happening on your shows?
YouTube.com/Matt Binder tonight at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Tune in for another episode of Leftist Mafia.
All right. Sounds good. I'm not sure if we have Brandon. Maybe at some point we will. We'll figure it out.
I'm reaching out to him now.
All right. We'll read some
IMs. Call him?
Oh, sure. We'll read some IMs as we get going here. Woke Con is local, said... Hearing from Foster and Hamawi helps restore a lot of the hope I've lost with the ongoing genocides in Gaza and Lebanon. I hope we start to see the mainstream shift soon with more and more progressives gaining momentum with the American public, even if it's years late. Well said. Arun with a view. Muslim doctors as politicians. Really good track record here. Yeah, at least in this cycle, yeah. 2 for 2. It reminds me of the poll of Abdullah Sayed, speaking of him, that they took in Michigan, and it was like 100% of the non-binary vote, and the sample size was like 2 people. Thank you, Matt. And we do have Brandon. See, I knew it. We have Brandon. As we set him up, I'll read one more IM here. Tempe from Maryland, 6 degrees hotter on average, even with this insane cold snap at the start of the year is insane. Without like a month of severely below average for half the country, I wonder how much hotter on average we would have been. Yeah. It's horrifying. And, the bombing campaigns in Iran are also major climate change accelerants, in addition to like the way that Trump has destroyed green energy products. or projects. Social conservative, fiscal liberal, abolish ICE has got to be the moderate position at this point. We're at prosecute and imprison ICE now and mass amnesty for undocumented immigrants. Late stage McConnellism. I have been following MR for 10 years and Emma for probably 7 or 8 years since the TYT days, and it just dawned on me that Emma is from Jersey, lives in Brooklyn, and yet is not a Nets fan, just making sure I understand this very important choice.
I mean,
people have, yeah, I mean,
is there a Nets fan?
Yeah, right. First of all, I'm also a Rangers fan, I'm not a Devils fan. There's no chance. You know, my dad doesn't really care about sports, but the one team he actually cares about is the Knicks. There was no chance that I was getting out of that growing up. So I think that's also
crazy. Your dad isn't a sports fan. So like your love of sports didn't come from like your dad. That's crazy to me.
No, it came actually much more organically kind of later in life. I just became obsessed with the Giants really. And that's the Super Bowl era. I was really, really like a big fan of the defensive line of Michael Strahan and JPP, and I just got really into it that way. And then I went and I was at the Super Bowl when they won the second time against the Patriots, the last time they won in Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. Got tickets last minute, stayed in a smoking room in a motel because all the hotels were booked up, and during that trip, I got a coffee in Indianapolis, and I was putting the top... is everything okay? Okay, I'm just filibustering, telling a personal story anyway. They gave me a coffee in Indy. It was like in one of those like styrofoam cups that you would probably put soda in, you know what I mean, typically?
Yeah.
And one of those... it's just like it wasn't a good coffee cup, and I pushed down on it, scalding hot coffee with that lid, and it like buckled, and this was thankfully after the game. It exploded on my face, and I had huge burns on my forehead for like,
oh my God,
4 weeks. Yes. So anyway, but I don't remember that part that much, and I remember more of the Giants winning in front of me. And now we have Brandon, so people don't have to listen to this anymore. Hello, Brandon.
I enjoyed the story.
Thank you.
I thought
it was
a great story too, Emma. I was listening off camera, and
you know.
I also remember watching that exact game as a heritage New Yorker, as Trump would put it, and it was very meaningful to me as well, even though I didn't take my love of sports into my adulthood.
Yes.
Besides
yes.
flat fighting, of course.
I mean, the more meaningful one, which I was still just starting to get into it, obviously, was defeating the undefeated Patriots in the 07-08 season, because that was such an underdog story. I mean, it's, you know, I think even non-Giants fans will say that's one of the greatest Super Bowls of all time, just for that reason alone.
Yeah, I hate both teams, I agree.
Okay, there you go. So I didn't go to that one, but I was up in the nosebleeds really high up, and I did get to see the Mario Manningham catch from that vantage point, and I saw, you know, Ahmad Bradshaw fall ass backwards into the end zone. Okay, Brandon, what's happening on the discourse?
Oh, well, you know, we have just been trucking along every morning from 8 a.m. Eastern to 12 p.m. Pacific over on YouTube at The Discourse with Brandon, and the same on Twitch. And it's just a great time. It honestly, it has never been better.
Wow. Wow. I love how we're all adopting the Trump hyperbole. Oh, my God. Oh my God, what is on the screen right now? Stephen A.
Meeting of the minds.
Is embarrassing New Yorkers. Just put this up here so you can see what I'm reacting to. Why?
Oh no.
Why?
Oh boy.
Look, I know that his politics aren't great, but I've still been able to enjoy his bluster as a New York sports fan.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can even go there anymore. Like, this is the kind of thing where it's like, it's too far gone. You're too much of a right-wing hack for me to...
Yeah, it's a New York deficiency that you were ever so tolerant of it, in my
opinion. I love that image. Because to me, it looks like if you were trying to cast, like, an angel and the devil in, like, an early 2000s Adam Sandler movie.
Yes,
like, if,
right.
Like, if the... like Little Nicky too. Like this would be like the angel and devil who guided Adam Sandler's Little Nicky, titular Little Nicky.
Yep, in the white hoodie. In the white hoodie, he's going to give him the good advice, and then the dark Sith Lord over there, Dave Rubin, telling you, yeah, no, you should do X, Y, and Z. I could see that.
It would've been Dennis Miller early.
To be fair, there are some points of disagreement in this discussion. And I've actually zeroed in on one of the main ones, which is Dave Rubin is a big supporter of Ron DeSantis, including Ron DeSantis's education policies, particularly the ones pertaining to like how it's, we teach about slavery.
Yeah.
And so Stephen A. Smith did have a little bit of a run
of a tiff.
This. So yeah, let's check this out.
All right.
And I'll just say Dave Rubin prefaces this with details about the Florida economy and how great it's doing, and I would just say it's not doing well at all. You can't get insurance there, and you can don't
Miami's
take my word
losing
for it.
People.
Yeah, exactly. Take Rick Scott's word for it. Who is, if he had hair, it would be on fire with how much he is freaking out about the economy right now. But here's Dave Rubin and Stephen A.
Doors with maybe one kind of 7-Eleven.
Oh,
sorry. Let me just slow that down because I'm not going to waste too much of my life on this stuff.
Been mom and pop shop and something else. You go to our strip malls here in Florida, they are jam packed. The economy is moving along. There are jobs.
Oh, perfect.
All of the COVID stuff, how well he managed all of that and fought to keep the state open. So I wanted to do a show where we will celebrate that and show people, especially, you know, we're doing this June 11th, but we got our 250th anniversary coming up on July 4th. I want people to feel that there is a way to do America right, and we're doing it in some of these places, but you just got to be willing to see it.
And
but you should ask him that question.
I am going to ask him that question, no question about it. And in the interest of full disclosure, let me not be phony here. I'm a Florida resident my damn self. I migrated, and we ain't lying to the public. You're damn right I did it because of New York and the taxes and everything in New York. I'm sick of it, and no question about it. So
sure.
I'm with you in that regard. But, you know, getting back to the slavery curriculum thing, yeah. I remember one time I was a guest on Jesse Waters' show because Jesse Waters, I think, does a good job. And I was a guest on his show, but I hadn't been on as a guest in quite a while. One of the things he turned me off about, and Ron DeSantis had turned me off about the same time, I found myself looking at them and saying, you're not black. Why even bring that up? Why even talk about it? I said, I don't give a damn what trade you learned or whatever. It was so iniquitous, so insidious, the issue of slavery. Why even touch that? That was my attitude. And the same with the curriculums, with the books and everything like that, with President Trump and what he endorsed with executive orders and stuff like this, addressing DEI. My attitude was this.
Look at Dave's.
And I said this to Officer Tatum on his.
Dave's doing the someone brought up Sam Cedar face.
Yes, yes, yes. Blink. Pretend you're paying attention. Or Jillian Michaels reminded the audience that I'm gay. That's more, I think, what. Yeah. We'd see more terror if Sam was coming up. I just got to say, like, the foreclosures. Yeah. First, and I'm sorry, I still appreciate it when he's using like sports adjectives and cadence in this piece of commentary, but whatever. What do you say, insidious? Yeah. And another one. Florida's foreclosure filings in March were the third worst in the nation, behind only South Carolina and Indiana.
Okay, but what about the strip malls?
Bankruptcies. In the past 3 years, bankruptcy filings have more than doubled in the Middle District of Florida, which runs from Fort Myers to Jacksonville and includes Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. Filings are up more than 30% in February in just the last year. The highest tally in any February since 2015. Credit card debt. Floridians carry some of the highest average credit card balances, around $9,000. One in three cardholders in Miami, Tampa Bay, Jacksonville, and Cape Coral carried at least $10,000 in a balance, placing all four in the top 10 metro areas nationwide. This is an article from the Tampa Bay Times about this.
Yeah, those wokies.
Credit card debt nationally, just in terms of the state of the economy, it's dipped slightly in the balances in this quarter, but the previous quarter was the worst ever in terms of total of credit card debt, and it continues to go up. And subprime auto delinquencies continue to break records. Like, the economy's really bad nationally, but as I just laid out, it's even worse in Florida.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just very heavily divided in Florida, too. Like, Florida, in terms of the global economy, is, I think, the 19th or, like, some high-level, high-number economy globally. But when you look at the working class in Florida, they're looking to leave the state in droves. The housing market in Florida is one of the fastest cooling housing markets in America, along with Texas. And DeSantis' solution right now that he's trying to push through the state legislature in an emergency session is to abolish property taxes, which has people going, like, okay, but how are we going to fund, you know, anything really? How are we going to fund schools? How are we going to fund fire departments? How are we going to fund, well, the police? But, you know, DeSantis is imagining there'll be some sort of private public solution to that, a trust fund or something. And so this is just to mitigate some of the extreme inequality going on in Florida right now that's causing people to be unable to live there and looking to leave. Because the truth is, you can't have a state of only millionaires and expect that to function. You can't have a state of only, like, uber wealthy people, because, like, that's just not a functional state.
Right. Especially because, like, also for these companies that they're trying to attract there, they want to go where the talent pool is. And it's not in Fort Myers. It's not in Orlando. It's not even in Miami. For a lot of the companies that make the economy run, it's New York, it's San Francisco, it's LA, it's Austin, it's whatever. But it's not Florida. It's just not.
Well, if you're talking about strip clubs. But let's get back to Dave Rubin.
Yes, and we didn't even really address that him calling him out about the racism of the DeSantis administration. I just got to say, though, Stephen A., why is it only when it impacts you that you have these critiques, or where it's like a sensitivity for you in particular? I don't know.
I mean, that's the true Republican in him. There's nothing more Republican than that, right?
Right. Yeah.
My attitude was this, and I said this to Officer Tatum on his podcast. Okay. Come to me and tell me that would tell the Jewish community they ain't gonna have, you know, they're gonna have their access limited to books and other education material about their history, and watch what happens. In other words, if you're gonna do something like that, if you did it to everybody, then I get where you're coming from.
But no.
When it seems isolated towards the
Let's not burn all books equally.
That's so good. Look, you could ban books about the Holocaust if you're going to ban books about slavery.
But wait, Dave's got a good response to this. So,
like, if Hitler wanted to kill everybody, I'd get where he was coming from.
Right, exactly.
It's
the discrimination that I have a problem with, not the mass death.
Black community. It was a huge turnoff for me. And that's actually a question I will ask Byron Donald, too, who will also be a guest on this show in the future.
I'm glad to hear that. I don't know that there was limited access to the Black community to certain books, but I would say this, you know, if somebody wrote a book and said, and I'm sure books have actually been written.
I'm sorry. But that's not what Stephen A. was just saying. He was saying that books were not that Black people were being blocked from accessing books under this administration. It's that books about Black history are being removed. That's right.
Isn't that the same thing? What's the distinction?
I don't know. I thought Dave's distinction makes it sound
Dave wants to double back to a different thing DeSantis did, okay, which is the curriculum that said actually Black people learned a lot from slavery, avoiding the things about how wholesale books that taught about slavery were just ripped off of the curriculum because Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
If somebody wrote a book and said, and I'm sure books have actually been written about this, that, you know, the Holocaust actually taught the Jewish people a certain lesson, and that look at how many Holocaust survivors became unbelievably successful business people and all sorts of things in various countries, that would be true, and it would be worth noting, because the Holocaust was horrible and slavery was horrible. We don't have to play the game of which is worse or anything else. There, right. Terrible things have happened to all sorts of people. But out of terrible things, good things do happen. So I think an apples-to-apples equation would be, is it possible that some slaves learned trades that ultimately were positive? I think the answer to that is yes, and I don't think that makes slavery good. And is it possible that survivors of the Holocaust who had their families annihilated learned something about survival and everything else that they were able to then apply to business and the world and family afterwards?
That was crazy.
Yeah, it started off really, really bad.
And so it started off really, really bad. But then it was like kind of just kind of stupid in the middle. But then at the end, it got really, really, really terrible. And I was just waiting for it to be over. And he just kept going.
Oh, my God. So he's saying
the secrets of Holocaust victims.
That basically if black people just pulled themselves up by their bootstraps like the Jews did after the Holocaust.
Then... We should celebrate the trades that the black people were forced to learn under their slave masters in the South. Which is literally what Ron DeSantis was saying.
Also, there is something that's really important here that's a bit of a difference and part of why you have reactionary right-wing forces in our government that want to deny the impact of slavery and Jim Crow. It's because we did it. Like, that's part of the issue that we're talking about here. This is what censorship is about.
Also, literally, like, book, you mentioned the books thing, because, again, Ruben is zeroed in on this thing that conservatives want to actually, the hill they want to die on, is that we should be allowed to say that slavery benefited black people to some degree. But it's actually true, that, which is, obviously, everyone knows that's insane. But also, that, like, Toni Morrison's beloved, Abram Kendi's stamp from the beginning, which, you know, I don't like Kendi's association with what's-her-name, but that's a good book, in my opinion. They're just banned.
Yeah,
and I mean, the, like, Matt is saying, the idea that slavery has benefited black people because it, like, introduced them into, like, the Western world, which everyone benefits from being a part of, it's an old idea in, I think, racist circles and also, like, just mainstream circles sometimes. And it's become more mainstream over the years, seemingly. But that also just fits into the way that people conceptualize all of the genocides and atrocities that have been committed by Western civilization. Like, they put them as, like, prerequisites for the completion of this, you know, grand project of the United States. And so, yeah, they were bad, but they ultimately resulted in the United States being here. And so how bad could they really be? The weird thing is people don't usually do that with the Holocaust. Right. Usually people tend to, like, exceptionalize the Holocaust and put it outside of its place in modernity because they want to make it seem like this isn't something that the West would do to other people in the West. It's, you know, just like an eccentricity. But him going full, like, yeah, maybe they learned, like, accounting in the concentration camps, and that's why they're so good at business after, like, that was wild. That's what he said. I mean, like, I'm just,
I mean, kind of, he did an anti-Semitism a little bit.
I feel bad saying it out loud. I'm like, that sounds really anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
I want to hear. I mean, it just shows how
me too.
It shows how dedicated they are to that. You know, we were just talking about how there's like a weird, like, right wing. Focus on saying that there were good things that came out of slavery. It just shows just how dedicated they are that they're to that, that they're now pushing the same for things like the Holocaust.
Yeah, I saw Sandra Hüller, the German actress, was like at a film festival. It came on my feed and was asked about like how she should, as a German person, doesn't ever want to forget the shame of the Holocaust because it allows, like, the shame is important to keep it in mind all the time, right? And but that's the conservative frame of mind, is that they want to absolve themselves of any negative feelings or any systemic critiques because they're little babies. So what, like, you're talking about there, Binder, is the fact that because the United States oversaw the horrors of slavery in the instance where we're comparing it to the Holocaust versus how it can be exceptionalized to pump up United States nationalism because we were against the Nazis in World War II, and it's much more convenient for us to look like the good guys. They don't like that, how the reality of slavery makes them feel.
This is
from
also
a national pride perspective in the United States. Go
this
ahead.
Is why the Republican Party will always be white majority, because Stephen A. Smith is trying
so hard.
This party,
yes.
This is the kind of shit he's going to run into over and over and over again.
Yes. What's his reaction here?
I don't know if you're going to be super impressed, but let's go.
So he just moves on?
Well, I'll play it.
Business and the world, like, and the family way. Afterwards. The obvious answer to that is yes, and that doesn't make the Holocaust good. But again, I think it would be worth unpacking that with them a little bit. And I'm sure you know a few of the people, a few of the scholars who put that curriculum together, by the way, were black. So
Nice.
I get it. I get you are going to have a certain sensitivity to something that might be different than mine. And this is where, what a great place to try to whittle all of that down, right? Imagine if we whittled all of that stuff down to, hey, we're just from slightly different places. We just look slightly different. We want the same things, and we've whittled it down to this much. I'll do that all day long.
Okay. So would I. Cool. Dave Rubin right here with Stephen A. Straight Shooter with Stephen A. Getting back.
He just used it as a segue. That's all he did. Yeah.
Straight Let's dodging. Move on. Yeah.
Damn. Oh, my God.
Whittled it down to just the Holocaust and slavery.
Every cloud has a silver lining. Like, yeah, it just all got reduced down to like a stupid, I don't know, platitude.
That's really incredible. Bullprog, Ruben, if anyone is going to like silver linings, .. I'm not sure I get that one. June Oliver, Ruben's horrendous argument reminds me of the Canadian Christians who argue that the genocide of indigenous people was a net positive because many converted by force to Christianity. This evil worldview continues to dominate many spaces.
Oh, yeah, that's not just Canadian Christians that trot that one out.
Yeah. Michigan Fist says, I love Dave Rubin's logic on the slavery / Holocaust statement. My family may have been brutally murdered, but look how well I have learned to cook for one.
Also, I think, kind of famously, the world response to the Holocaust wasn't just like, hey, well, Jewish folks, you learned something, right? It was right. Like a massive reparations project that sort of devolved into the monstrosity that is Israel right yep. now. So does he support reparations, or how does he feel about that for black people?
Tony32UK, I just realized that Dave Rubin is almost the spitting image of Carmen Gia, the director's butler from the original producer's film. He just needs the eyepiece and necklace. I don't remember that. Paris Smart, Dave Rubin is the face of a man who's a real connoisseur of his own farts. Revolutionary Status Quo, I love watching the tension in Emma's face as she's torn between her geeky, passionate obsession with sports and the embarrassment associated with her geeky, passionate obsession with sports. Yeah. That's pretty much a view into my brain, yes. Four-person Cedar, it's super disrespectful to play anything other than the M Majority song on Thursdays. I'm writing a letter to Mr. Cedar. Respect women, Brian. Galactic Nurse Books, medical professionals and teachers from all branches of government, please and thank you. Hearing Mallory McMorrow say she has a background in industrial design and that's why she should be elected had my eyes rolling all the way back into the into my throat. Kermit's Fat Hog says, I don't think that the German remembrance of the Holocaust is an ideal way to atone. Since October 7th and well before that, before I moved to Berlin 3 weeks before that, they've used accusations of anti-Semitism to spy on and sabotage left movements and social institutions. For example, the Berlin City government canceled funding they'd already promised to an organization that tried to host an anti-Zionist panel that was exclusively hosted by Jewish people. Yes, Kermit's Fat Hog. We've had a German reporter on to talk about this dynamic. I was speaking about this actress's statement in isolation of, you know, like the German government's policies. All right, let's check out the sound sheet here. Where is it? Here we go. Okay, what should we... one sec. Let me think for a second. Let's just have fun with this Benny Johnson thing, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
The glass house section?
Well, I was about to say. I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I see, like, really cool real estate comes on my algorithm, like, look at this mansion, look at this ski chalet, and I don't know, that's my,
we have different algorithms.
Yeah, it's sometimes I like
ski chalets in my algorithm.
Sometimes I like looking at real estate for fun, just to see. I play a little game sometimes where it's like, what if I were drafted in Kansas City as a football player? Let's look at the real estate around here, what I could buy with this contract. Okay, this is just my little hobby that sometimes I enjoy, so my algorithms picked it up. So sometimes I get these houses on there and they have these huge windows and I'm like, how are you going to fund heating this house? How are you going to make sure that this house is heated or it retains heat or air conditioning because it's just very expensive. You know, I just don't know how expensive it would be to live in a fully glass house to heat that one. That was a long wind up. I bring you Benny Johnson. Just move on.
Oh, but we're stuck with James Tallarico, and I'm no political consultant, Jesse, but here's three things you could ask him to defeat him on a debate stage. He says there's six genders. Well, why don't you name them? You say you have a girlfriend. Why don't you name her? And you say that Jesus is pro-abortion. So how do you square that with thou shalt not kill, the Ten Commandments, something I'm pretty sure that Jesus wanted you to uphold. So, once again, the reason why Democrats are failing is because they've given up on masculinity. They've given up on testosterone. They've given up entirely for effeminate, estrogenetic, catty, and totally embarrassing candidates like Beto and Beta here. And most importantly, the American people know what leadership looks like. It looks like President Trump winning 119 out of 119, a 100% endorsement record. Donald Trump is winning across the board. He's showing
primaries.
Strength. He's showing calm under fire. And he's showing what the American public want, which is clarity and not confusion.
Benny.
We want to play the girlfriend naming game.
Yeah, they've given up on throbbing masculinity.
Yes.
In exchange for disgusting vaginas.
James Tallarico. James Tallarico won't even admit that God has balls.
That's true.
And that's why he's not normal.
Yeah.
When he's in heaven, he won't be asking to see God's massive hog. Like, isn't that like utter shame?
Yeah, if Tallarico has a girlfriend, how was I sucking his dick last week? That's exactly what he said.
Oh my god.
Checkmate, Lib.
Do you think they can ride out Tallarico's a soy boy to electoral victory in November? Man, I mean, I know it's Texas, but they've really got nothing.
I never count these guys out with the stupid what stupidity they come up with and still somehow manage to eke it out. It's amazing.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if, like, look at this guy. He eats a turkey leg with a napkin. Is able to overcome, like, how much the cost of, like, a turkey leg has gone up in the past, like, 6 months because Trump decided to start a dumbass war for Israel.
Just seeing a Daily Beast headline from earlier this year, MAGA wife uses posting frenzy to say her husband is straight. Want to guess whose wife was the woman?
It could be so many people.
It could be. Or it could be the guy that was just on TV there, because it's kind of an open secret at this point, right? I mean, I don't want to get sued or anything like that. I don't know for sure. But many, many people are saying, that Benny Johnson's in the closet. It didn't seem like Jillian Michaels even rejected that notion, by the way, in her debate with Sam. She just kind of like took it at face value. Same with Steven Crowder, too, which is interesting.
It's his truth.
Yeah.
Is it that he doesn't have a rape accusation? Is that why they're like they've given up on masculinity?
There are two kinds of Republicans, rapists and closet cases.
Sometimes there's overlap.
Yeah.
If he were really straight, he would be like homoerotically bullying his staff like Steven Crowder. Can you even say that you're straight if, you know, your producer hasn't had their, you know, their shoulder begraced by your testicles?
Yeah. Graced. That's a really, really kind way of what to describe the action. More like smushed against.
Like a parrot on the shoulder of a pirate. That's the kind of humor Steven Crowder brings to the front page of Rumble every day.
Prop humor. Alex B. Brian making me break into laughter here at my office. Good thing nobody overheard me regarding Tallarico. Teishu, Ken Paxton lost his eyesight originally in his eye because someone threw a berry at him. He should fear vegans. Is that true? Oh, berry. No, there's no way. Cole, not from California. A lot of these Texas hogs have sons that might or look or sound like Tallarico that they don't hate. I don't think it will take them all the way to November.
That's the thing is, you know, I don't know who's going to win. If Christians in Texas are like Christians in North Dakota, like you will have been exposed to weird Christian guys like Tallarico that say stuff that seems strange in like a God context. And also like generally those people aren't frothing at the mouth to bully trans kids like Republican politicians are. So like I wonder, particularly with women in Texas, if there's going to be either a shyness to support a philandering fraudster like Paxton in the wake of just like a nice young man who they would like let like watch their kids on Sunday.
Right. Let's do something else here. Okay. All right, we'll do this then. So Jeff Bezos went out there and he claimed with no vested interest in any of this that taxing the rich isn't going to do anything, so you shouldn't even try. He claimed that his taxes could be doubled and that teachers in Queens wouldn't be impacted at all. That's what Jeff Bezos said. And so Zoran Mamdani was asked about this by Caitlin Collins on CNN, notably as the mayor of New York City. And this is what he had to say to Jeff Bezos, one of the wealthiest people on the planet.
Speaking of executives, Jeff Bezos told CNBC last week on taxes, and obviously, you know, what you've said about affordability is looming in the background of this. He said that you could double his taxes, and as he put it, quote, it's not going to help that teacher in Queens, I promise you. What was your response to that comment from Jeff Bezos?
You know, I know a few teachers in Queens who would beg to differ. And I think that if I was worth as much money as he was, then I would probably say the same thing. The fact of the matter is that we are talking about a city where one in four New Yorkers are living in poverty. And we're hearing from one of the richest men that our world has ever seen about how he and others who make that kind of money shouldn't have to pay their fair share. And frankly, what New Yorkers want to see is a tax system that recognizes the scale of this affordability crisis and actually provides a way for city government to be able to invest in those same New Yorkers in the manner that we used to decades ago.
Speaking of
it, it's just incredible how Bezos offered that up really so casually, as if he thought it would work just by, and it's really how things work for billionaires. It's why it doesn't necessarily matter if they're sociopaths before they become billionaires or sociopaths after. It creates the sociopathy and a disconnection from regular human beings because everything is served to you. So he thought he could provide some sort of evidence-free claim about how if you raise my taxes, it's not going to help people. It's not going to help people who are in poverty right now. Okay, based on what? And you think that you can go out there and just by sheer force of will, I don't know if he was speaking to some financial press that would have taken that at face value, but billionaires like that, they have just a bunch of sycophants around them that are like, oh, so true, so wise. Yep. And I just want them to get in front of cameras more often and say what they think. Because frankly, it's not that difficult to make a case against somebody who says, don't raise my taxes. I don't want to help teachers. It's not going to do anything to help teachers. You know what everyone's thinking about when you mention the elephant in the room is, hey, maybe your taxes could really help teachers and more taxes on you could really help teachers. So.
Of course. I mean, I do think some of that stuff has changed, though. I feel like if he had said that 10 years ago, we would be subject to some sort of PolitiFact-style four Pinocchios argument where it's like, yeah, Mamdani says that taxing Jeff Bezos another 5% would help teachers, but there is no way to prove that that money would go specifically towards education. It might go towards helping garbage men or some other public sector that we need to fund. So, you know, eight banana peels. They would give them some sort of like fake rating to sort of delegitimize the point the same way they would do to any kind of point about medical bankruptcies that Bernie would make or any point about the unfairness in the way in which we like redistribute money from, you know, the bottom to the top. It's always like job creators and trickle down economics. And, you know, it's only been recently that people have just like pushed back against that to the point where it's like it's not even getting out the gate.
Yeah. I mean, I think even the response to the one big ugly ass bill, this tax bill, is evidence of that. Like, we have cut taxes to the bone, specifically for the wealthy, but, you know, and disproportionately so. But the cost of living part is not solved right now by people getting a few hundred or maybe a few thousand extra in taxes and in their tax return. It is unable to keep up with the pace of inflation and the over, and inflation's really only a part of the story. It's a corporate consolidation, price fixing from whether it be algorithms for your rent or whether it be some of these grocers or food suppliers that chose to artificially keep their prices up after the supply chain bottlenecks from COVID subsided, and they took home record returns. And those are public with public companies. We can see what you're taking home. And yet they are still publicly calling it inflation and claiming that it's otherwise, this is just the market naturally responding to things. And so, you know, a tax cut bill doesn't have the same political salience, to your point, Brandon, that it did 15, 20 years ago, because our economy is fundamentally at such a broken place due to the tax cuts being so disproportionately geared towards the wealthy. So that, like, even the economy as it's structured is unable to properly function for 99% of people because the wealthy have consolidated so much power that they're making it work for them.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think I just want to point out too that, and I think traditionally people like Jeff Bezos would strictly make the argument that, like, you know, their money is better off with them because they're the job creators and they could help more by creating jobs. And that's why they shouldn't, you know, be taxed less. And I know they still make that argument. And I believe Bezos even made that argument along with this other one he made where, well, my money's not going to go to help up teachers in Queens. But, like, I think it says a lot that they're adding this other part to it now, because I think they are starting to realize that timeless argument that we need the money to create jobs isn't really hitting with everybody anymore, because all you have to do is sort of look around and see either A, the jobs aren't being created when we don't tax these guys, or B, whatever jobs they do create, they like pay subservient wages that require you to go on welfare programs anyway.
Well said. Exactly. They are. If it's not on the job creation stuff, it allowed people to be subservient and not have like class consciousness and collectivist viewpoints where they understood who the real enemy was. But we're not at a place right now in the economy where that makes sense. And the oligarchs that we're talking about here that are so, like, the tech oligarchs in particular, the AI reaction that is happening across the country, the fact that people fundamentally understand that this is about taking my job away and not providing me with anything that I can look forward to or stability. Like, you know, my stepdad was at the same company since he was 22 until he retired and had a pension. And it's like, that doesn't exist anymore. You can't make the arguments about jobs and economic stability for people who are experiencing the most unstable economy of their lives.
And on top of that, like, I feel like, you know, obviously this is the argument usually from these types, like the tech industry, is like, oh, what about when, you know, they automated factory work and, you know, they automated this part of car making or whatever. And they bring up all these other previous past technological advances. But the issue here, I think, is like, usually there's someone who benefited from those, like maybe prices would drop, things would be a little bit more affordable in some way. There would be some group that benefited, some regular, ordinary group of people benefited in some way, consumers, you know, for example. But we're seeing now that AI is being rolled out in everything and nothing is changing for the better. Nothing's getting cheaper. There's no savings being passed to the consumer from these companies that are saying, oh, we just got rid of all of our employees or this whole department and we replaced them with AI. There's nothing tangible that people are getting out of this other than the very rich who are being able to pay less wages until, of course, they realize that they're actually losing money off of AI because AI can't replace people and they got to hire back all their workers. But I think that's the difference here. AI has done nothing to make really any normal working class person's life better, easier, cheaper, yep. more enjoyable, nothing.
And that is important to point out because technology in theory, or like what is sold to people in terms of what technological advancement is supposed to engender, is an ease in your everyday life. Things that used to be more difficult are now more automated or more easily done with tasks. That's how previous advancements in technology worked. Trains getting faster, your car is able to go for longer, for example. What is this technology doing except polluting your water, making your community more unsafe ecologically, and replacing your jobs? But according to Stephen Miller and the Trump administration, they're actually building an economic paradise. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Matt Binder and Brandon.
A second point, Sean, is the American people understand the hell that we inherited and the extraordinary paradise that President Trump is building, from record inflation that we had under President Biden to the cost of living going down faster than it has ever gone down before.
Unreal.
From unaffordable energy to the great American energy boom, from violence, bloodshed, and chaos in our streets, as I mentioned, to record public safety, from a wide open southern border, the mass invasion of our country, to the most secure border in American history, from woke policies that push transgender insanity and critical race theory and racism and prejudice in our schools to a world of sanity, a world of stability, and a world of meritocracy. On every issue, President Trump has pushed policies that are the heart and soul of the American belief system, the mainstream center of what Americans believed, and he's led with competence, with courage, and with clarity. And the American people will reward that come November. I am sure of it.
All right, Stephen. Take that to the bank, buddy. I mean, anybody normal tuned out after the first 20 seconds when he claimed that the cost of living is going down at a record pace. It's just amazing. Just say anything.
You know, Fox News has really devolved into like copium 24/7 television. It's a real like hug box, safe space type zone over on Fox News as it pertains, especially to like the Iran war and the disastrous consequences thereof. Because like it's basically every other video they're talking about. Actually, Iran is super weak. It's so weak. And we haven't lost control of anything, actually. And Donald Trump is just one day away. And I think that has like, I don't know, just diffused out into all their other content as well, because people are starting to notice. Like, people are starting to notice that the prices are not going down. You mentioned the tax cuts. That was all eaten up by the increasing cost of gas. The cost of gas has been increasing steadily for 7 weeks now, because we've been at war and partially at ceasefire for that entire time. So, I mean, a lot of people don't even have the tax refund extra that they were supposed to have because it was eaten up. And that direct one-to-one, or like that direct line that they're able to draw between having that go from their paycheck to like paying for Trump's legal war, very unpopular.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's another reason, though, that Democrats should not be swayed by some of the bright, shiny objects that's being thrown their way about things like no taxes for this income bracket. We need to be making a positive case for taxation because, like, the economy is not functioning without with the way that we have completely obliterated our tax code and policies for years. It's not about money needing to flow around and consumers needing to, you know, just have a few more $100 in their pocket. It's just not going to be able to be offset by the amount of consolidation and greed that is manipulating our economy right now. So someone writes in and says, like, Stephen Miller, Carl Demsock, I didn't realize how nice it had been not to hear Stephen Miller talk for a decent while. It is interesting to me that he's getting back out there, because I feel like Trump maybe put him in a little bit of a cage or something. Like, after the disastrous occupation of Minneapolis, it was like a bad look to have this spitting psycho out there. But it feels like, and it also feels like he's tried to slow his cadence down a little bit. But I just want to make sure I say this. The people that are watching Fox News, though, are the most isolated people from the impacts of the economy. And they are still going to be impacted, to your point, Brandon. But these are all boomer homeowners. And you look at polling even on the Iran war or on Israel and support for Israel. It's that same cohort. It's over 50-year-old Republicans who probably own a home, probably own a small business. Maybe their mortgage, they've stopped making payments on it 10 years ago, and all they have to deal with is their property taxes and they're fine. Like, they're going to feel the impact of it too, but they're talking to an even smaller audience. The problem is just that group of people really likes to vote and votes in high numbers. All right, let's open the phone lines here. 646-257-3920 is the number. Eric in Poland, Trump and Stephen Miller have an amazing ability to lie to themselves. On what planet is the cost of living going down? I know Trump and Miller both live in a bubble surrounded by sycophants, but still.
Suddenly, well, part of it is just obviously lying.
And yeah, he's a Goebbels-style liar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another part of it is, honestly, they do, especially someone like Trump, they do live in a bubble. Like, Trump doesn't know how much things cost.
Yes. Yeah. Like, remember how he keeps saying that you need to use an ID to get into the grocery store?
Oh, yeah. They're just denying reality, because they're hoping, at the very least, if they can't make you think that the prices near you are lower, they can convince you that you're isolated. They can convince you that, like, well, maybe I'm the only one who's noticing this. And so, like, you will be cowed into silence, into, like, you know, reinforcing this false reality for yourself.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not saying he would be truthful on his own. Obviously, he would lie. But I do actually think, for some of these things that Trump spouts, he actually believes it, because his right-hand men all lie to him. Yep. To the point where... He just believes it. Like, he thinks that they're telling him the truth.
Yep. Science is political. There's a study where if they tested if AI tools would help software engineers code faster. They predicted it would result in tasks being done 24% faster. However, the study showed the group with AI tools were 19% slower. This was a scientific study. Interesting. Chicago Tim, to Matt B's point, you can shut any AI booster down by asking them to name literally one product that's improved in the last 4 years.
Everything is worse now. Everything is worse.
Yeah.
Like, everything is made cheaper. Nothing works like it's supposed to.
But, like, not cheaper to pay for, just cheaper.
No, everything is cheaper, like, made cheaper. Like,
worse
quality. Worse, like, user interface, if it's a software product or whatever. Everything is worse now, because there used to be a care about this stuff. There used to be people who designed products actually looked at it as a form of art and cared about the value they were offering to consumers. Yes, they wanted to make money, but they wanted to make money by providing something worthwhile to people, and people would pay for it and be happy with what they purchased. That's not the case anymore for so many things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And also, I think everyone has had a chance to use AI who has wanted to use AI. And unless you're a kid in school looking to cheat on your homework, it hasn't really revolutionized your world.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, like, you know, you've probably at this point worked at a job, if you're still allowed to have a job in Donald Trump's America. They've had you use an AI tool to take notes from your meeting. You used it for a few weeks. It stopped working. You never updated it. You never read the notes anyway. And you stopped using it. Maybe you used, like, ChatGPT a few times to, like, answer a question for you, but then you just stopped because it wasn't that useful.
Right. All right, let's take a call here. Calling from a 308 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
This is Kowalski from Nebraska.
Kowalski from Nebraska. I was hoping you'd call in today to talk a little bit about what we mentioned at the start of the show, that great Bloomberg article about how food prices are about to rise for the second straight month, and they go into all of what farmers have had to deal with this extreme weather and the high costs.
Well, shoot, I wanted to talk about the Knicks.
oh!
All right, no, it's fine. yeah, so a bit of an ag update on that. Things are pretty bad if see, like, we were expecting food prices to go up with this super El Nino just because of the effects it has on global production. So, like, 2012 is a good year to think of for the United States historically. That's when, like, the big drought started in the Southwest. That's when the Midwest got hammered really hard from a sustained heat dome, which led to a prolonged drought in the middle of pollination season. And when droughts occur in the middle of pollination, the plant can survive, but its yield or the grain or fruit that gets produced, whichever it is you're growing, just gets reduced. So, like, here in the U.S., in the Midwest, we should expect there to be, like, a minor decline in our yields. The crops might still be there, but, I mean, even right now, early on, we're seeing, like, wheat failures in the western half of the Great Plains.
Yes.
Which is
in that,
really bad.
In that article that I mentioned, all right, I lost the print version, but I have, like, the here, I mean, this is crazy, that wheat crops, as of May 19th, Bloomberg writes, 70% of U.S. winter wheat production was in areas of drought. 70%.
Yes, from some of the things I've read in West Texas, their winter moisture, well, they didn't get any moisture from basically September up until about, I think, late April. Mm-hmm. So around 5% of their wheat crop just failed. It didn't grow. A lot of what remained was going to be very subpar. And places in the Texas Panhandle, western Kansas, they've depleted a lot of their groundwater supply over the last 30, 40 years because they didn't manage the aquifer. Unlike Nebraska, who in the 1970s had some very forward-thinking policies put into place, we actually did maintain our groundwater supply. They couldn't even irrigate out of this issue. So that's not that wouldn't necessarily be that bad, but the problem is El Nino is a global event, so they were already forecasting there to be floods in South America, a potential drought in India. If a drought hits India, because, like, there could potentially be a monsoon failure, how big this disruption will be. And if a place like India loses 10, 15% of its production, that's catastrophic. That is a global problem. Like, the UN has to meet and start making decisions, kind of a problem. I think a lot of people forget just, like, how precarious famines can be because, you know, the biggest famine a lot of people think of, right, would be, like, the Chinese famine in 59 to 61, which killed anywhere from, like, 30 to 50 million people in China. If you actually crunch the numbers, that was only, like, a 3% failure rate on the Chinese system because they had over 670 million people. If only 3% of the people starve per year, I mean, that's the number. They still fed over 650 million people. It's just that's what happens when you do not have a surplus. It's one of the reasons why, like, in every society, we value the idea of storing grain during the good times, so there's grain during the bad times. But it just seems like, you know, when you live in a world that is hell-bent on no resiliency, no surplus of anything, you know.
Efficiency, aka extraction.
Yeah. I mean, would you want to drive on a bridge that was built efficiently or effectively?
Exactly.
You know, it's 95% effective. Oh, that means catastrophic failure. So, yeah, not exactly a great system. So there's not a lot of good news out of that. That in the United States, we do have irrigation, but the Colorado is really damaged now because all the snowpack was destroyed in March with that big heat wave. The snowpack was already going to be at like 25%, but the heat showed up like 2 months early. And
I think I read that too.
Another unprecedented.
Another climate impact, like, you know, another climate change impact, another tangible impact of the extreme weather.
And on top of that, at least for the United States, we have chronic labor problems because of the Trump administration's just horrible policy. Well, it was actually part of the Obama administration as well, the first Trump administration, and then Biden never really solving it. Like, we've been hemorrhaging farm workers for a long time. Their wages had stagnated, and yet we can always find subsidies for the big corporations. Why we couldn't subsidize wages, go figure. You're also seeing, like, a lot of the processing plants and whatnot are suffering. Like, meat packers, in order to keep their profit margins high right now, as demand is slipping, they're trying to cut more and more of their workforce. I mean, you know, Tyson plant got whacked here back in January in Nebraska. 3,000 people lose their job, basically destroyed the whole town. Nothing really happened. I mean, it's pretty dire, and it just seems like a lot of the politicians who could have really stepped in and done something just do not either care or do not fully understand exactly what is going on. I kind of view it as more ignorance than malicious. They're evil people, but I just don't think they're intentionally trying to be this evil.
I guess that doesn't really matter, but...
No. There was another thing I did want to mention quick.
Go for it.
There is a very good chance that the Democrats will pick up the second district in Nebraska, which is basically the Omaha metropolitan area. But there is also a lot of activity right now in Nebraska's first district, which consists of Lincoln, Norfolk, Columbus, and Fremont. And the reason for that is blood is very unpopular. The farm vote is likely to be suppressed this year because people are pretty pissed about higher costs. Farmers in that side of the state are a bit more aware of the realities of what Trump has done. When you start getting away from the bigger population centers, that's where you get your, like, really brainwashed people who
right.
do not understand anything. So there is a very good chance that independent candidate Austin could actually be a contender, or the Democratic nominee. The independents and the Democrats really need to hammer out something over the summer, whichever candidate they think is more likely to win. But Nebraska this year or last year recently became 50% urban.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a very good chance Nebraska could be on the verge of being just a swing state. I mean, seems like all the pieces are falling in place.
From your mouth to God's ears, Kowalski. All right. Thanks for the update. Not much positivity, except a little bit at the end.
When the negativity hits you, you just got to sit back, take a deep breath, and just say to yourself, ain't nothing going to break my stride. Ain't nothing going to slow me down. There you go.
Beautiful.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks. You too, Kowalski. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for being on the right side. Incredible. Chris from Memphis, the Guardian's reporting on Netanyahu announced the IDF would cede 70% of Gaza. We did touch on that in the interview. I think I incorrectly said 60%. So it's worse than what I said, but Zach corrected me.
It was 60%, and then they started chanting 100%, and Netanyahu was like, well, let's get to 70 first. Yeah.
Democracy.
Yeah.
When you said democracy, I was thought you were going to say demonic, and I was about to be like, that was exactly what I want.
Democracy.
Yeah. Why can't Father Time take out the right people?
Well, it would make zero difference if not.
Yeah, fair enough.
A lot of people are thinking the hologram already, some sort of AI projection, since he's been, like, you know, glitching a lot.
Have you been hearing about this in the conspiracy corners of the internet?
I have, actually. Ever since, like, he disappeared and they went into those proof of life videos and they were saying they were AI generated, but it really, you know, popped up again today. What I was surprised by is that, you know, it's all because of the underlying war between the reptiles and the, I'm sorry, I'm flanking on it, the Anunnaki that are playing out on the earth between Iran and Israel. And Netanyahu was one of the first casualties of that war.
Yeah. Okay. Understood.
Probably should have led with that.
But. Yeah.
I mean,
big story, it feels like. All right. Let's take a call here. Another call calling from 346 area code. Is this where you're calling from?
Hi. Is this me?
This is you.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I have a lot of thoughts. I'm Isaac from Austin.
What's on your mind?
Well, like I said, I have a lot of thoughts. I have a lot of thoughts on Tofu Tallarico. And I know this isn't the most important issue right now, but it still gets under my skin. Because I am a vegan in Texas. And, you know, over years of just being normal around people, I've managed to carve out a little bubble of acceptance in my personal community. But people really do get rabid about veganism here. It's ridiculous. At the same time, I dream of a future where we can actually legislate some sort of curtailment of animal agriculture, because it's lighting the planet on fire. In my mind, the first hurdle is, like, just get to the place where someone can run for office, and when someone calls them a vegan, they can just say, yeah, so what?
I mean, Cory Booker's a vegan, so.
Yeah, I know, but in Texas.
In Texas, okay.
Yeah, I just feel like a lot of leftists will deride veganism or vegetarianism as, like, a performative personal issue. But it's only performative insofar as there's no possibility of it ever becoming a policy issue. And for it to become a policy issue, it needs a real constituency. And I was wondering, like, what do we need to do to get to the place where a Texas Senate candidate doesn't have to demean themselves by, like, gloating about how much steak they've eaten?
I don't know. I mean, it's going to get better. But let's go ahead, Brandon.
Isn't it illegal in Texas to, like, insult the meat industry, given how big of a part? No, I'm actually asking, because I remember that from an episode of King of the Hill. Like, it's an actual law in Texas that, by nature of, like, how important the, like, ranching and meat industry is, that, like, you aren't actually allowed to, like, denigrate or insult the, like, the meat industry. So I think the caller's point takes on extra salience in the, like, the context of Texas, if that is still the case or was the case at any point. But I mean, I have to imagine that there's a big lobby for meat in Texas specifically, that, and this is kind of like a cultural downstream effect of that. Like, meat is so normalized there, right?
I mean, I think so. My understanding is also basically limited to the King of the Hill episode, but I've watched it several times. So
I think it has something to do with Oprah too. Didn't Oprah?
Yeah, Oprah. Yes, yes. This is all, like, ringing a bell.
Yeah, wow. She, like, dissed hamburgers or something, and then, like, the Texas cattle industry sued her.
That's absolutely hilarious to me. I'm sorry. I hear where you're coming from, and I applaud you for being a empathetic person that's thinking about the world and thinking about your consumption choices and what you're putting into your body and trying to make a better world for that. I don't necessarily have your discipline, so I am somebody that thinks vegans are doing good stuff and, like, trying to make the world a better place, and I respect it.
How to make that a political asset is probably a longer-term question. I think generally it's better just to make it less relevant to a political, like, a lot of personal qualities, whether it's, like, you know, your sexual orientation or, like, your diet. I think when you're trying to build a large coalition, it's better not to foreground that stuff and try to make it, like, the thing that you win on, because unfortunately the world is divisive in this sort of way.
Yes. I also think that it's really dicey territory, in my view, to return arguments about environmental justice and changes to how we structure our government and how it responds to climate change, to return to a place where we're focusing on people's individual consumption choices. It is politically toxic. We have to make this about the economy, like we have to make almost anything about the economy. It's the most broad-based coalition that you can build. To Matt's point, an overemphasis on, say, sexual orientation or consumption choices and what you put in your body with veganism, with the exclusion of a class argument, is, like, the way that the Democrats have been running. Maybe not the veganism part, but, and I'm not trying to say veganism is an equivalent identity to race or sexual orientation. It's a belief and an ideology and a series of choices. I just do not think that we are anywhere close to being able to make that case. I think first we have to change the way that even climate policy is discussed in this country, and making it about, this is hurting you at the pump and it's hurting you at the grocery store, is the place we need to be starting, not let, you know, you love your hamburgers and we're about to change things for you.
I mean, I think like Zohran, he's doing this thing with the Eastern Parkway arch and trying to extend Prospect Park out so that the farmers market can have more basically space. I think that those affirmative things for, like, local food infrastructure, That's the types of things that need to be fostered and cultivated.
Exactly.
I would agree with that. And I'd also say that I was really excited by the prospect of the Green New Deal, because in my mind, it was basically talking to the American people saying, we're going to have to transition to a green economy, and we're going to give you all of the resources that you need so that that not only doesn't hurt you, but it actually makes your life better.
Right.
So I could imagine a future in which, like, animal agriculture is one of a suite of policies that maybe Americans find personally distasteful, which we can wrap up in some sort of big national project that they agree with, because it's also going to include all of the other aspects of the Green New Deal that would make their life fundamentally better.
I would be curious how we structure that, but I am not opposed. Appreciate the call, Isaac. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, one more call, and then we're going to get out of here. Folks, calling from a 703 area code, you are the final caller of the day, 703.
Well, is this me?
This is you.
Hey, it's Sergeant Flux.
Sergeant Flux. Where are you calling from, Sergeant Flux?
Western Pennsylvania. I called in several months ago because of my my relationship with the VA and my cancer diagnosis and all that.
Right. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing much better. Nothing's grown back, but, you know, can't really complain too much.
I mean, you can if you want.
No, I really can't complain about what's been done in regard to my care at the VA.
That's great.
Once again, it's one of those things where I just think about it every day. People are losing, you know, their access to health care, and I'm only here benefiting from it and haven't really seen any negative effects as to my quality of care, but you know, for people in my life who aren't as well covered as I am, you know, it's stressing them the hell out, and it's driving me nuts, because it's like, this is not the way things should be. But let's see. I didn't really want to. I guess I would say, to follow up to that, it's like, let's see.
You're all good.
I guess I was thinking about. I was thinking about the whole thing with Graham Platner, and that's what I called in today for. Was kind of a follow up on that. Like, I get real tired of the whole thing about the tattoo.
Yes.
And concerning that I was a sergeant of Marines myself, I've seen plenty of numbskullery going on in the Marine Corps. And to think that, you know, I think they're like, I am completely bought, like, I don't want to say bought. Okay. I believe his story. That he did not know what that tattoo meant or what that symbol meant when he got it tattooed on himself. He just saw it as a skull and crossbones in a specific style.
Definitely.
And, you know, definitely. No, yeah, absolutely. And tattoos are practically a culture. It's like part of Marine Corps culture to get a tattoo.
Yeah.
It's like, and it drives me nuts. It's like, they just hate him because of his particular policies. I'm just thinking to myself, like, they will grasp at straws for anything to drag somebody down. And that's it. It's like, in regard to stupid things that I've seen Marines do in my time in the Corps, it's like, there are more overt symbols that have been used and have had, controversy over. In 2012, there was a scout sniper unit that posted a unit, like a kind of deployment unit photo, where they actually had an overtly, everyone should know, symbol of the Nazi regime, which was the SS flag. They thought, oh, it's SS because we're scout snipers. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be interesting to have? And there was just a big It was a big controversy back in the day. And they should have known better, because that is overtly a fascistic symbol. So
Wait, did they end up getting it, or it was just discussed?
They had a SS flag.
Oh,
they put
God.
The American flag. They put the American flag over them. They put the SS flag under them, and then they kind of arranged themselves for like a little unit photo with it, and then posted on Facebook or something like that.
Oh my God!
And it just drove a controversy. The entire Military Times posted it on their like newspapers. Just absolutely crazy. It was.
I'm looking at the picture
of that time.
Brian's looking at it.
We don't need to put it up, but my God.
It's
a giant SS flag.
Okay. Thank God it wasn't that. We'll just say that. Anyway, I really appreciate you calling in and giving us an update. I want to, you know, I'm hoping that you're feeling better.
Also, quick question. How was the food when you were in the... Because the VA saved my life last year. Literally saved my life. But... the food almost made me rather die.
The food, I don't really eat lunch at the VA at all, really.
Oh, you weren't like holed up there for... Okay, I was in there for like 3 weeks.
Okay. Actually, no. I harmed myself quite a long while back. And, you know, the food wasn't really that bad when I was staying in there.
Oh, okay.
And that was another thing. But, that's a tirade for another day.
Yeah.
But I did have a question for Matt. Is he there?
Yes.
Yep.
There's two Matts. Pick your choice.
The one that can answer my question. Like, I remember, an episode from, several weeks ago that you brought up about, a Jewish, because I'm Jewish and I work with Jewish Voice for Peace in my area. And,
right on.
You know, we're getting, I'm looking up anti-Zionist Jewish commentators from way back in the day. You mentioned somebody who was anti-Zionist and recognized that the Zionist movement was fascist. And I can't remember. I wouldn't know. I don't want to go back to hours of Majority Report.
Tony Jutt,
Pedant? There's Tony Jutt's writings. I believe When the Facts Change has the... Is that the one?
I haven't gotten there yet.
But that's the one I gave you, right?
Yeah,
that's the one with
all
the Israel stuff. And yeah, I mean, the main essay for Jutt is Israel the Alternative came out in 2003, which is everything that needs to be said about Israel. It's a nationalistic anachronism that was always going to devolve into this kind of violence. And he was right. But I think that's probably who you mean. But there's Avi Shlaim, who was previously a sort of a two-state, born in Baghdad, but transferred to Israel on the founding of that country, and then has now become anti-Zionist one-state solution folks. There's Ilan Pape, another Israeli scholar, and Jeff Halper, who doesn't get nearly enough recognition, I think, in this field. He's another Israeli activist, anti-Zionist, who is active in the Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolitions, which is, you know, exactly what it sounds like. Zionists like to knock over Palestinians' houses, and he does a regular YouTube update that doesn't get nearly enough views. I always try to share it, but he's another great voice.
Appreciate the call. Thank you so much. We got to jump,
yep.
But
oh, thank you very, very much. Yeah, I should let you go. Bye.
Thank you so much. All right, guys, gonna read some IMs and get out of here. Drunk trailer park supervisor. My issue with Platinum. And the tattoo, isn't that, I
can
think...
we just, I don't mean to be gruff, but like, how much time of our show are we going to discuss this fucking symbolism that people have nothing else besides, go ahead.
Maybe I'll just respond really quickly. My issue with Plattner and the tattoo isn't that I think he secretly knew what it was. It's that when he talks about it, he says the military screamed me for hateful tattoos and they didn't say anything. Instead of saying the military said I was good, he should be asking himself why the military didn't have an issue with a Nazi tattoo. I'm still very concerned about his call to address the military recruitment shortage emergency. I don't think he has some secret plan to do harm. I just think he's a dumb guy that can't effectively criticize the military. He is not a dumb guy.
I would pretty bright. Here's a bit of advice. If you want to make a critique about Graham and say how he approaches the military and talks about the military and the future of the military, leave the dumbass tattoo shit out of it and leave it at that. Would be my advice. Like not couple in the dumb, literal minded schizoid stuff about a tattoo. I'm sorry. I think it's very obvious what happened with the tattoo. We got a tattoo in Eastern Europe. That's the type of shit they have on the walls there. I don't understand. There's no other associations that have come out in all this fucking time to suggest that anything other than that happened. So like drop that and leave it to the actual
criticize
real points.
It on the merits. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's just, it's unfortunate because this is, in my view, the most clear example of a Zionist smear campaign that continuously gets picked up by people who I think have meaning intentions in many ways, but it is just
part of it's even outside the Zionism. It's what Christopher Hitchens said. There's two types of people. There's literal minded and people that are capable of having a ironic detachment about certain things, which is that some things can mean other things in different contexts. Literal minded people cannot deal with that. And so when they see a tattoo, despite nothing else to suggest that this guy's a Nazi, they think he's a Nazi. It's moronic, frankly.
BGC, okay. He seems like a dumb guy protesting Bush, then enlisting. I'm sorry. Like, this is just, have you ever met anyone in the military? Everyone has contradictory opinions about that. And additionally, yeah, Graham didn't have to fully go into the military. It wasn't like it was like that was the only way he was going to get into college or whatever. But this is about someone who wants purpose and wants to make a difference and see the world. That's how a lot of people join the military. Yes, it's for the GI Bill and for college, but sometimes it's that as well. God forbid somebody who's in their early or late teens, early 20s has like a moment where they choose a career path that gives them a sense of purpose and duty. As he's talked about that over and over again. Like, we have to be really careful with this, like, anti-veteran, anti-military stuff. It's really politically toxic, and it's not how you win in so many areas of this country.
I mean, very clearly, the people that are, like, all vets must die. Go win a primary.
Yes, enjoy running for elections on this. Famously, the United States doesn't care, like, it doesn't have parades for veterans or anything like that. I mean, it's just...
I would argue they don't care about vets, but they definitely pretend to.
Yes, well, exactly. And he joined Blackwater. You keep following up because he explained it. He was didn't have like a sense of direction.
The Blackwater
is
even a fucking thing. I'm sorry. We need to stop doing this stuff where we hash all this dumb bullshit. Okay. Because the Blackwater thing again, like that's the thing that all the ultras for Left Reckoning wanted us to talk about. Guess what? That's not even the most relevant part, because the Blackwater stuff was diplomatic security. Yeah. It wasn't like he was in fucking Fallujah, like, as Blackwater. You want to talk about his military stuff? Ask about that. The stuff before Blackwater, before he was running fucking security for translators or whatever the fuck.
Three more. Cottonmouth just had some Trump slump stickers arrive in the mail for my wife's birthday. She absolutely loves them. Left is best. There you go. Rural Lefty, Texas Tribune reported in 2018 that back in 1996, Oprah aired a show about food safety, in particular mad cow disease. So Oprah said that discussion stopped me cold from eating another burger. Cattle industry sued her, and she eventually won. But during the lawsuit, Oprah brought on a so-called jury consultant who eventually became a regular on her show. That consultant was Phil McGraw, a.k.a. Dr. Phil. Look at this origin story that we have here. And thank you, Brandon, for pointing this out about Texas making it illegal to criticize cattle, the cattle industry. And the final IM of the day. Parasmart, how comfortable are y'all with consuming art from horrible people? In the extreme music world, there are some very sketchy people, most of whom are insane, who do really amazing music. I don't give money to Nazis, but in black metal, that's a hell of a minefield.
Yeah,
I would imagine. I think, you know,
I don't ask on certain genres, and that's one of them.
Right. Like, I think, you know, do not judge yourself on your individual consumption choices. It is a burden that you should not have to bear that often in a society that gives you very few choices.
But once you know, it's hard to forget.
But once you know, look, you know, like I can't even like think about Harry Potter anymore. I just don't care. It gives me the ick, and it was something I cared about a lot growing up.
Radiohead was my favorite band, and even and like the Greenwood stuff and the Milquetoast position on Israel. Like I can't listen to their songs the way I used to. Like every once in a while, I'm like in a mood, I can listen to there maybe and keep it moving, but. Never listen to a full album again.
I mean, certain actresses' Zionism has ruined a lot. Like, there's a, yeah. I mean, and so it just is, depends on where you draw the line.
I used to love Gal Gadot movies before all the Milton Zionism.
I was a bit of a defender of Amy Schumer's show Inside Amy Schumer, but I did find out later that, like, she didn't write a lot of those sketches that I loved, right? Or... maybe was involved in them.
Oh yeah, I mean that's a lesson for every show.
Yes.
Very rare.
I would see her do a lot of stand up even before she became big in New York, and I thought she was pretty good. And I mean,
the one that broke my heart was Sarah Silverman. I mean, I loved Sarah Silverman very, very much growing up. I watched Jesus's Magic probably 400 times in a row, and so yeah, that sucked. That sucked. All right, guys, with that, gonna wrap up here. Appreciate you all. Thank you so much, Binder, Brandon, Matt, and Brian. We will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. Between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost the drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. Shifted in and out.